evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Ladies and gentlemen, we are talk doing the most by applying our hearts, applying our minds, applying. We are talking about, first of all, we're going to finish now the conversation around money and relationships. And in the second hour, we're going to dive into how to become a fun person because, Fela, you guys are getting ready for December. You guys are getting ready for December and you guys have to be on your best behavior. You guys have to be at your ultimate bestest, and you guys are also going to be chilling with besties, and then it's just going to be best, and then everything's just going to be best, and then it's just going to be best, and then it's going to be the best. You know, Busta Rhymes, Twista on the mic. So we're going to be talking about being your best self and creating the best personality for yourself, or, you know, just little gestures like that. And then from there, we're going to either round it off with a wholesome conversation or we're going to round it off with story time. So good evening. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch. The number in studio is 083-288-401. That is the number in studio. So the question is, for this evening, right? Should women have their own money within relationships? Hey, now you guys are like, yeah, I want to know. So this whole concept of should women have their own money? When I look at this concept, when I look at it from my perspective, I don't even think this is a fair question. I don't think it's a fair question. I don't think it's a question that you should ponder on. I don't think this is a question that you should bring up during debates. I don't think this is a question that is it's above your pay grade, okay? It's above your pay grade. If you are asking this question, it's above your pay grade. Simply because I don't think that men have a fair fighting chance. There, I said it. Well, the world is moving towards benefiting the girl child. And that is why. So if the world is moving towards benefiting the girl child, then shouldn't we say that the girl child should be a contributor to the relationship? Now, I don't know who told you guys about buying love. I don't know who told you guys that you guys have to spend so much money in order for somebody to love you, your personality, your PP, all of that, you know? Because people buy. People buy love. People buy friendships. People buy relationships. Do you know that there are adult children out here that are actually paying, right, for their parents to love them? They are narcissistic parents, to love them, you know, so they give them money, they fix their houses, they do all these things just for the parent to love them. Now, that's most now just buying love. And it's not even love. It's like paying somebody to do something good for you. Like a doctor or a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a social worker. Paying. You pay them to listen to your problems. You pay them to fix you. You pay them to help you. You pay them. They're not doing it out of the goodness of their own hearts. No. And even the state ones are getting paid. So there's no charity here. So I don't know who told the boy child or told the man that a woman is not a contributing factor to the relationship. I don't know who said that women can't be providers as well. And I don't know who said that women are these damsels in distress that need to be rescued by some prince charming on a horse, or we can say a G-wagon. Yeah. In a G-wagon, you know, with good cologne and a bank account, fat check. I don't know who said this, but I don't think that this conversation is a conversation that you need to miss. Especially if you have sons. You know, one thing that I think many of us take for granted is that children look at us and think that we are superheroes and we're superstars. So the little things that we say in passing, maybe towards to our friends or to our cousins, and you don't really mean it, right? But you say these things, the children catch on to it. Because if you ask me today, how many men I know that were told by their parents that they must pay for women's schools, I would say zero. If you asked me today how many men I know that were told by their fathers, that they must be paying for some girl's university. They must be paying her rent and buying her groceries and putting on electricity and water in a place that he doesn't even live. And when he goes there, he only stays the night and then he has to go back. He can't even stay a whole full weekend. I would say none. Maybe just maybe the dads are not saying it. But I wouldn't say that the dads are not saying it. I think that men have this chronic need to lie to one another. And this chronic need to lie to one another is the one that's trickling down. It's a lie. It's a fib that was told. And somebody just ran with it because they couldn't unlie the lie, because the lie was already spiraling out of control and it had now become a spider web. So, Chomi, I think that men and women should come together and do whatever they want in a relationship. Yeah. Can we just stop? Because we all have these standards. We all have these imaginary standards. A man must. A woman must. A man must. A woman must. For starters, if you are asking for the impossible, eh? You find women that ask for a lot. But it's only a lot to you that doesn't have. We spoke about this yesterday. It's only a lot to you that doesn't have. And you think that it's unfair because you want the Ferrari. Mara, you can't afford the Ferrari. So you now bash the garage. Yeah? You bash the garage. You bash the Ferrari. That thing is expensive for nothing, man. It's just a car like every other car. If it's just a car like any other car, then why don't you get a car? Huh? Why don't you get another car then? Why do you want this one? It's because you know a Ferrari is a Ferrari, baby. It is what it is. All right? So that would now go to us in relationships here. Can we not just allow people to do whatever they want in relationships without an opinion? Apart from like violence and, you know, deadly things and crippling things and detrimental things. Apart from that, Is it really honestly our place to always be advising, unsolicited advice for people's concepts of relationships? Because you might be duping your friend out of an entire relationship that's actually tailor-made for her. And you are basing it off of your preferences, off of your style of love, off of your expectations and standards of love. And you're duping her because maybe she's highly persuadable. And you dupe her out of a good relationship. The other day I was talking about the fact that there's this one guy in a guy group, right? There's this one guy in a guy group that if he doesn't get married, usually he gets married just to stay in his friend group, you know? So he just, the girl that he's seeing, if everybody kind of likes her, even if he's not in love with her like that and all of that, but she's a good person, you know? Not his type, not his preference, not his what, but everybody likes her and she's a good kid or she's a good girl. Sorry, kid, not kid, but she's a good girl. Then he would most probably marry her. Most men, the single friend in the friend group, right, usually just marries so that they can now all be at the table with his friends. Because when all his friends marry off, he's left alone. And when he's left alone, he's literally left alone. Meaning that these guys go on double dates, wives and husbands, and he can't come because he's single. And also people don't want their pictures filled with strange women that he's bringing up every single time that he comes for holidays and stuff. And so they just stop inviting him because he doesn't know what it is to be a married person, right? Now this guy gets married so that he can still stay included. But one thing that this guy doesn't realize is that he could have been the first one out of his friend group to actually get married had he not been the type of person that is so easily pressured, right? Easily pressured by his friends. So one of the pressures that happen when you guys are a little bit younger is that your friends have an opinion on the person that you're dating. The person that you're dating, is usually scrutinized and ridiculed or condoned, or sometimes given a round of applause because your friends like her, your friends don't like her. Now, if your friends don't like her and they don't think she's pretty and they don't think she's nice and they don't think she's good, right? And you are not having a strong spirit, then you usually leave this girl. Now, this girl is usually the one that was probably going to be your ultimate, like your, the love of your life kind of girl. It's usually when you are younger, and it's usually when you guys are a little bit reckless and all of that. When you guys are younger, your friends don't like her because she doesn't want you to go out. She doesn't want you to be drinking all the time. She doesn't want you to be spending all your money in a bar. She doesn't want you to be not buying your things, you know? So she starts influencing you to become a dude, to become a man. And your friends don't like that because they are in that era. But the problem is when their girls come, the ones that, you know, that influence them into becoming men, you guys are all game for it. Everybody is game for it. Nobody really, steers the other one astray. Or even worse, sometimes your friend just abandons ship. He just abandons this whole entire friendship and he's just with his girl everywhere all the time. Every time you see him, he's just with his girl. You can't even really go and visit him because his girl is there. Then the girl and him are living together. Then they are getting married and then you guys are invited, but it's not that deep. And then they only really hang out with married people and then your bra is gone. And then you get back into that guy's graces. When you get married, then you become his friend because now his wife likes you, right? Now you're wondering, what does this have to do with money? Well, I believe that it is not really about should a woman bring her own money to the table. I believe that if that is what you require as a person, if that is what you require as a person, as an individual in contemporary times, then please allow her to bring her own money to the table. Good evening. Yes, Tate Buana. I'm fine, thank you. How are you doing?
No, we're doing good.
Aha, thank God.
Yesterday, there was one of the presenters.
Yeah.
Who was talking about, you know, the exorbitant amount spending in those issues of wedding. And what I got from her, if I got it correctly,
yeah,
she was actually against some of those spending and all this other thing.
Yeah. But it was more about our spending styles and seeing our compatibility, not just in love and relationships, but also in how we handle finances in relationships.
Exactly. So that really gave me another understanding, which I think the way we do our things, because many a times when people are, if they can just be coordinating, because even though their estates are not yet as joined.
Yeah.
Well, and then because that's the thing. But in terms of possessing some of this item and things like that, if they can really coordinate properly. I don't know how, for me, honestly speaking, when it comes to events of those natures, but they are always well organized. But not much.
Are they really well organized, or is it? I think that also one of the diseases that men have, right, is that you guys assume that we have our lives together because we are women. Because you don't find me at J&J drinking. You don't think that I'm an alcoholic. Because you don't find me at the casino gambling. You don't think I have a gambling addiction. Because you don't find me standing outside smoking, you don't think I'm a smoker.
But I don't want to change some of those habits if you feel it's not perhaps in terms of compatibility.
No, but this also goes with just because, right? I look good and I smell good. You don't think that I'm bad with money.
Yeah.
And this is everything about women. Men underestimate women so much, and that is why women are taking over their whole everything right now, because they underestimated a woman.
Even if for us, we know that women are very powerful.
No, you guys think we are powerful because we birth children, not because we are actually intelligent creatures.
Yeah, you are. We value those ones also.
Mm.
But then
do we really?
Even though, at least the issue of really manipulating us also through intelligence, intelligence is also something sometimes disturbing.
Mm.
So it is not much encouraging, but so we understand and we value those values.
Mm.
But sometimes, I don't know how they just take advantage.
Yeah.
Whether you like it or not. For me, sometimes it's good to, it's profit.
Mm.
Because at times they adjust our behaviors. Mm. And even though you find them, many women who can also be alcoholic and addicted to some of these things.
Mm.
But I think it's in normal situations. They do not really engage in that thing unless
But who said that? It's because of that idea that we have conversations like this. Because you think that under normal circumstances, they don't really do that. Why not? Are they not people with emotions, with feelings, with situations, with problems?
Yeah, maybe they feel that my problem should just be managing my husband, see how we can produce children, see how we can enjoy, content with this life here.
Mm.
Even though, of course, there may not be a lot of money, but they are easy to change.
Mm.
So maybe they know that the consequences of these things will be they want to bear the much burden. So many a times, if the husband, the father has become like in that manner, that way. So the burden, I think, comes too much on the women in terms of raising the children, in terms of provision and things like that. So I'm just thinking that they might also have that fear, the conscience that if we keep on doing these things,
if you continue,
we become alcoholic or maybe irresponsible sometimes. Maybe it is going to be more worse.
But the only difference, there's no difference, Tatepwana, and this is something that I need you to understand. There's no difference.
Mm-hmm.
There's no difference between a male alcoholic and a female alcoholic. You just want to see it because you see the best in women. But the truth is that
you can't picture it. I have seen a lot of men.
Yes.
Who are alcoholic and they were just lying down in the street.
Yes.
But a few women will see them lying down in the street. Yeah.
Because they go and lay down at home and beat their children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe that's why.
Yeah. They go home and beat their children. Or they get raped in Momilamba Yakol. Yeah. And just because that man is sleeping in the road, where it's actually even safer to sleep in the road than to sleep on lamp. Like, it's true. Just because somebody stayed, Tatebwana, doesn't make them the best parent.
Mm.
You know, as a person that has, like, when I compare odds, right? We have to also look at the parent that stayed. Because especially with children that had absent fathers. Children that had...
Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, please. I'll call you back.
Okay. All right. So with children that had absent fathers, right? Good evening. With children that had absent fathers, right? I believe that many children that had absent fathers have this idea of their fathers. They have this picture of their fathers that is not true. They have built castles in the sky of their fathers that is not true. Like, yeah, my father, he's such a great guy and he's such a what and he's such a what and he's such a what and he's such a what. And I just want to be a part of his life. You know, and even if the child is told, deadbeat and what, 90% of these kids love their father so much, even if he's gone, but they love their fathers because of the rejection, from their fathers, or the idea of the rejection, because in many cases, it is not that they were actually abandoned or rejected. It's just that their mothers have a tendency of putting them into one little bowl and saying that your father left us. Your father didn't leave you guys. Your father left your mother. Right? And now you that is left now with your mother. So your dad has this idea, right? When he's getting a divorce from your mom, your dad has this idea that mothers, right, are the best types of parents to stay with their children. And also your mother is not going down without a fight. Your mother is fighting for her children. And it seems as if, you know, the whole custody thing, it's on her side. And when it's on her side like that, she's winning by default, you know, because of the law, she's winning by default. And your dad thinks that you are safest, right, with your mom. And you think that, you don't even think that your dad thought that. You think that my mom loved me so much, and that's why she stayed with me. That's why she stayed with me to raise me after other people ran away. But that's not necessarily true. I don't know. Maybe you guys can ask your parents. You know, for you guys that have parents, that some of your parents are fully, both of them are alive, you can ask them. You can ask your parents. I think you guys are old enough also now to ask your parents, which are, yo, what's up? What really went down? Because you guys don't even ask that question. You guys just pretend it didn't happen. You guys just answer people's questions when they ask about, oh, your mom and your dad. And you're like, yeah, they were not together. They've never been married. My parents, you guys answer these questions like it's some of your business, but it's actually none of your business. You know? But anyhow. So now you assume that your mother is a saint. And this happens a lot with boy children. Boy children have this kamini obsession with their mothers, right? I don't know. This kamini obsession with their mothers. And boy children see no wrong in their mothers at all. And I'm not talking about these young, small fights that we have in our households. No. I'm talking about really the idea that you have of your mom. You hear every single man in this world saying that, yeah, my mom was a saint. My mom was such an amazing mom. You know, she took care of us. But in many cases, it's a parent's responsibility. Should we really thank parents for taking care of us when it is their responsibility to do so? Maybe you can thank them for the stuff that they didn't need to do. They didn't need to give you the best education. They just had to give you an education by law. They didn't need to give you a best education. They just needed to give you an education. They didn't need to buy you the most expensive stuff. They could have just bought clothes, but they went the extra mile. Can you thank them for the things that really are out of their way? But you can't thank your mom for buying food. She's supposed to feed you. So now every time you see your mom coming into the house, you know, slaving away, working 10 jobs, Tupac's mother, working 10 jobs to take care of you guys, and you assume that you guys had a great childhood. And I've seen this a lot. People assume that because they had the one parent that stayed, they had a good childhood. It was rough, yes. It's usually financially rough. But it was rough, right? But their mother made it through. You know, their mother pushed them through. I say this a lot. But also, what happens in mother household, there is a lot of abuse that happens. There's nobody that beats more than a mother. There's nobody that's beating you more than a mother. There are certain mothers, ne, that, yeah, karakwara, like yo, yeah, karakwara, fast. Nakalene akwa toko depression ane, muchofwere mo ne membo mononde, woo. Nakalene eri mo financial burden, what, and yo, netan dengera mo ne mo. And you don't see it. You don't see the fact that you've got bruises and you've been beaten. You've been beaten and you've sometimes slept with hunger. There are so many things. There's like a whole abuse checklist that I can read out to you guys. And you guys will realize that that whole entire checklist is your childhood with your mom. Right? And I don't see you guys calling it like it is. I don't see you guys saying, yeah, my mom was abusive. But God forbid it's a father. God forbid it's a father. If it's a father, my dear, it's like he's an enemy. It's like he's scum of the earth or a big scary monster that's coming from there. And if he does it, my dad was so abusive, man. He was beating me and he was, my dad was so abusive. You know, the other time he was dragging me from school, soccer. My dad was so abusive. You know, he used to beat us and all of us. Like, we hear this a lot about men, but we don't hear your abuse stories by your mothers. And it's because of this idea that you guys have. Right? Of what women are. You guys think that women are fragile. You guys think that women are fragile. You guys think that women are meek. You guys think that women are timid. And this information right here is exactly the information that we as women use against you. That is why, right? My Swara was telling my mom-in-law the other day, when we are traveling back, when we're driving back, now this is a squad of girls, right? When we're traveling back, we have to travel in booty shorts. And she's like, but why? You know? And she's like, what if we are speeding and there's a traffic officer? If we get out and we are showing a little bit of bum, then we'll get out of traffic tickets. Now you as a man, can you say that? Can you say all you have to do is wear shorts? But you guys can't see this. You guys see it as harmless flirting. But if some guy like did it, it's totally unacceptable. And this goes with everything that we do. You can be the only girl in a carpenter class and you can literally pass that course, right? Not unless the lecture makes you guys do practicals and tests where they are evaluating you specifically, right? Alone. But if you guys just do group things the whole year and you are a girl, you will get away with it. You will get away with not actually learning or doing anything in carpentry school because all the boys will do it for you. Or you have to, even if it is the ugliest girl, even if it is the ugliest girl, the weirdest girl, but the fact that she's a girl, we overlook it. And now, that's now where the conversation around money in relationships come in. Because if we are doing the whole thing about money and relationships, we would have to say what money is. You know, like not what money is, but what it means to you. And if it's important or not important, we'd have to start there. But for me, in contemporary times, I do believe that can we not depend, right, on girlfriends and boyfriends? Because girlfriends and boyfriends have this tendency of thinking that you owe me. Or you owe me for everything that I've been doing for you and I'm not even your husband. You see, you never really hear a husband say things like, yeah, I paid for her school and now she wants a divorce. You never hear that. Why? Because he feels like they've shared so much. They've shared so much within the relationship. And usually the finances then are split. Really, honestly, they are split. There's just, I feel like it's only people that are not in committed relationships and not in marriages, right? That have this concept about money and relationships. I feel like it's only you guys, because if you guys had real relationships, you guys would know that in relationships, we share. we share the money. If it's my own season, then I'm going to be spending. But when my own season finishes and your own season starts, right, then you spend. It is what it is. So if a woman should have her own money during a, within a relationship, I think that the only woman, what a woman should have always, especially if she's not the, especially if she's not the dominating person in the relationship, so she's maybe a very quiet person, a very, you know, reserved kind of person. I think a woman should have a safety net. I think a man should have a safety net. I think everybody should have a safety net where they can walk away, and walking away will not jeopardize their lives in any way. There are many people that are staying within relationships that are not conducive, that are bad for them because they've got no means, right? They've got no means and they've got no future prospects. And I'm talking about doesn't have an education, never worked a day in their lives, just straight from wherever they're coming from. And this is their reality, you know? And then you find those that actually do. There's the thing about housewives, right? You get married to this guy and then he chooses that, no, please give birth to our kids. And when you give birth to our kids, please stay with them. And when you stay with them, I'm going to give you a little something. I'm going to give you an allowance, a wife allowance. And you accept, right? So when you accept this, people don't like to think about the worst when they are in love and happy. But me, I think about the worst. I think about the worst and I think about the best. I put everything on the table so that I have an exit plan. So that even if things go south, we must have an exit plan. And I don't only have an exit plan that benefits me, I have an exit plan that benefits you as well. Right? So, if your husband is going to tell you to stay at home and be a housewife, then you must sign a contract. Sign the contract, sir. If he signs the contract, then it's going to be great. Because then now, you can go and use it, which are like, yo, this man kept me out of job, like, kept me out of work for 10 years, 20 years, right? And right now, I can't go back into the job market. I'm rusty. I haven't worked in decades and all of this. He must continue paying this salary. And this salary must have an increment after every 3 years or so. You know? Like, these are the types of things that makes your case stronger. Now you guys are all just accepting, oh, madala tatumo. And when madala doesn't like you anymore and madala stops sending that money, then what happens? You see? Then you guys are going to be in hot water. So I think that everybody should have a little bit of something and put it away for rainy days. And putting away for rainy days is not to say that you want rainy days to come. No, it's not to say that. But it is to know that even if something happens, right, you can walk. The power of walking. The power of going. Yeah, that's what I need you to have. As a man, I need you to also have the power to go. Jah, I don't want anymore. I'm out. Like, yeah, I'm going to take you for everything that you have. I'm going to what? Can't you just have your savings pocket? Because a savings pocket is not like an account. You just have your savings pocket where you just put your money there. Yeah, even when she goes into the joint, into the bank, what? She will not find anything. Make another bank account. Put your savings there. I'm not saying put your savings there for you and your mistress. No. I'm saying, put your savings there so that if things go south, you find her cheating, eh? And she's the finance officer. You can just go and swipe a room and sleep. Not these things of now the relationship crashes and then your whole entire life also crashes with it. Like, So when we talk about money, I would like to say that it is a thing called coercive control. So We as Eagle Media House do not claim any ownership of this. We're just going to use it for illustration purposes, and we're going to come back. So, ladies and gentlemen, please do call in and come and tell me about what you think about our speakers and their messages that they are speaking, because I put this out for us to hear what the world has to say about certain issues, and then we can have an opinion on it. So, this is Dr. Ramana.
Hi everyone, I'm Dr. Ramani, and welcome back to this series, a sort of glossary of terms related to narcissistic relationships and narcissism. This series came out of my thought that I think a lot of people are like, what does this mean? What does that mean? And some people have never even heard some of these terms. So it was my hope in this series not only to create some clarity and enlightenment, but also maybe open you up to knowledge about this field that may help you understand what your experience has been or understand other things you're reading or hearing. Today, we're going to take on the topic of coercive control. But before we go on, I'm always going to invite you, please consider subscribing to this channel and also hitting the bell to get notifications and hit the word subscribe to subscribe. That will give you the opportunity to also get notifications as more and more content comes out on this topic. So let's take on this topic of coercive control. Coercive control has been defined by various people, various sources, as a pattern or a strategy of a person doing things like using acts that include threats, menacing, intimidation, manipulation, stalking, humiliation, isolation, financial abuse, gaslighting, and sometimes physical or sexual abuse. The term coercive control was actually originally crafted by Evan Stark, who has been a major proponent and developer of this model and a key stakeholder in bringing coercive control laws into place in the United Kingdom. Now, the patterns that we observe in coercive control, these patterns are designed to isolate a person and render that person dependent on a partner for financial support, housing, food, and even their connection to the world. Coercive control results in slowly hijacking a person's life, stealing their independence, stealing their ability to take action, and governing every move that they make. It is controlling. It is manipulative, and it is exploitative. A person who is living through or experiencing coercive control lives in constant fear and with constant menace in their life. Domestic violence agencies have termed coercive control a deprivation of human rights and liberties. A study conducted in 2014 by Kelly and her colleagues estimated that 95% of domestic abuse survivors experience some form of coercive control. So, what does this look like? Coercive control looks like lots of things. It looks like threats and intimidation. And sometimes these are vague threats. Sometimes they're real. But they're always menacing and unsettling. Better be careful. You never know when I'm going to get you. They isolate you from families, friends, and workplaces. And this can happen gradually. Initially, they'll do this in various ways. They may insult your friends, plant seeds of doubt about their trustworthiness, telling you that your family is trying to sabotage your happiness and your relationship with them, sharing lies with you about your friends and family. And then just as the doubt overwhelms you, they also double down and restrict your access to them, and you may go along after all the mental manipulation. Another form is to isolate a partner from a job. Initially, they'll pitch this as benevolent. I want to take care of you. You deserve for me to take care of you. Stay home. It's okay. I want you to go back to school someday. You need to stay home with the children. And if a person is still working they manage to still work while being in this kind of relationship, the person engaging in coercive control may actively attempt to influence their workplace relationships or even make them look badly to their employer. And they may insist on dropping off and picking up a partner at work so they cannot talk with coworkers, develop friendships, have support, and so they can monitor their comings and goings. People who engage in coercive control also monitor your time and your whereabouts. And sadly, in a technological era, this is easier than ever. All kinds of things, a sort of find your phone app on a phone, tracking apps that can go on everything, spyware, trackers on cars that they present to you as a generous gift. People who engage in coercive control may do things like restricting normal activity, even things like grocery shopping or medical appointments or school events for your children, or always insist on accompanying you to any of these things. In coercive control, it's very common to see chronic verbal abuse, calling you terrible names, regularly calling you worthless, stupid. They may control access to information and services, and this may involve blocking your access to electronics or putting spyware on electronics, which means that all of your searches are monitored, and all computers and devices in a home might be on one unitary network. It's very common in these situations to see stalking, and this may be them literally following you around or doing it via devices or getting paid surveillance on you or asking people who know you, family, friends, people you work with, to provide updates. They'll do things like control basic elements of your environment, where you sleep, what time you go to sleep and wake up, what you are allowed to wear. And these could be experienced as being very restrictive dress codes. They may make demands on whether or not you're allowed to wear makeup, what you're allowed to eat. And one thing that is sometimes observed in coercive control dynamics is that they'll either restrict a partner to eat from eating or force them to eat. Another pattern we'll see is calling, texting, or video calling you constantly, constantly attempting to create access, even when you don't want them to. And if you ask them to not interrupt you and stop calling you as much, they will become enraged and call over and over and over again. And then they'll attempt to call other people who may be where you are. They will regularly engage in humiliation, degradation, and dehumanization of you, either when you're alone or when you're in front of other people. A popular trick of the coercive controller is that they'll ask you to FaceTime them or video call them or send them a picture, which I promise you they'll check the timestamp.
It's like dating a CIA kind of person. And usually with coercive control, right? They also start with money. So when we look at money and we say money is so dangerous, money is so bad, money is so what, right? I think that these are a few facts that we must actually know. These are things that we should identify before we can just throw out statements. We are in the era of throwing out statements and we don't know where it comes from. But luckily, you have the matriarch. The number in studio is 083-288-4001.
And they'll ask you, where are you now? Prove to me where you are now. If you try to send them an old picture, trust me, they'll remember what you wore that morning and they'll know you weren't there. They'll try to control your finances, even if you're working, and limiting access to any banking or credit cards. They will make threats. Again, these threats can be veiled or not veiled. And if they might say something like, hey, if something ever happened to you, I'd get away with it because I know the cops and they'd believe me. It is menacing and it is terrifying. And when you make a comment, they will gaslight you and laugh and get off on the fear that they created in you by making these menacing comments, saying things like, I'm going to ruin your life. They create a climate of fear, which is fostered by having all these sort of arbitrary rules, and they variably enforce these rules. But when they do, they will punish the partner in the home or the children or other people in the home through deprivation of even basic things like food, through humiliation, and through more threats. In coercive control dynamics, it's also not uncommon to see sexual abuse and sexual violence and forced sex. And this can include forcing an unwanted pregnancy so as to be in a better position to control a partner financially and the dependency fostered by having a child together. They'll engage in constant criticism of everything you do or say. Gaslighting is a very common dynamic in coercive control. And in a word, coercive control is relational imprisonment. There's also a spillover effect on other people because the coercively controlling partner indirectly harms the people around you because they may also, and hopefully they believe you, but they may also be experiencing the same fear, the same sense of grief and loss over not being able to reach out to you, to find you, to be with you when you're being coercively controlled. And then they also have to deal with the irritation of the stalking behavior of the coercive controller and the impact on their lives too. Now, obviously, this dynamic of all of the dynamics we've discussed is very dangerous and tragically.
Imagine having a partner that has all your colleagues' numbers. So every time they can't find you at work, they call your colleague, or they call your friend, or they call your sister, or they call your uncle, or they call your parents. They call everybody when they can't find you. And even though you told them that you don't want to talk to them, right? They can't take that no for an answer. So they'll call everybody to force you to have a conversation with them. That's if you're out of their grip. I'm just saying, right? I'm just saying.
In the cases of coercive control that do not culminate in physical violence or abuse, then many times law enforcement and other authorities will not record this as domestic violence and will not bring about charges or any other protective mechanisms. They'll often write it off as, oh, that's a relationship issue. Now, courageously, the United Kingdom has adopted coercive control laws, which is an important first step. But sadly, the rest of the world lags behind. People, and they are more often women who are in these situations, who find themselves in these kinds of relationships, are often written off by institutions and a whole variety of other pieces of law enforcement as dependent, or have this idea that these people could leave these relationships if they wanted because there's been no violence yet. And yet there are so many obituaries out there of women who were coercively controlled, who tried to get restraining orders and could not get them because it was only psychological abuse. And when they finally did leave, were murdered. But all of you are listening.
And this is exactly what is happening in this country right now. Eh? Because in this country, apparently you don't leave men. You wait for the men to leave you because otherwise you end up dead. But if we can understand what is happening, right, then maybe, just maybe, we can get out. We can get out of situations before they escalate to caskets.
Listening to this and you're saying, wait a minute, this kind of sounds like a relationship with a malignant narcissist. Yeah. And that is how this dynamic of coercive control connects to all this terminology we're discussing related to narcissism and narcissistic relationships. It is also a pattern we observe with psychopathic partners, but given the high level of overlap between psychopathy and a lot of elements of narcissism, we can see this as a pattern that these kinds of personality styles are likely to be the most predominant perpetrators of. So in this way, while I recognize that the work on coercive control has traditionally focused on the behavioral pattern, let's talk about the perpetrators. Let's think about what kind of person would be capable of doing something like this. This would be someone who lacks empathy, someone who's brutally entitled, someone who is incredibly controlling, someone who's motivated by power, someone who can't regulate stress or disappointment and manifests it as rage. someone who's hypersensitive, someone who's arrogant, someone who is deeply insecure. Sound familiar? And when you throw in some paranoia, willful cruelty, charm, and charisma so they can fool the world, there it is. That's malignant narcissism, right? Coercive control, like many of the phenomena we've been talking about, is on a spectrum. Obviously, in the most extreme cases, it is dangerous and it is even lethal. However, even on the milder end of the spectrum, and I'm not even convinced there's any mild form of coercive control, it can become a gradual process of being more and more controlled. And because gaslighting is such a prevalent dynamic in coercive control and in narcissism, the confusion and the self-doubt mean that the isolation and the ongoing psychological abuse slowly overtake a person's life. And because of the isolation, you do not have any sounding boards around you or places to get a reality check. You can't even log into a group and get support. And there also is going to be chronic criticism and humiliation and degradation and mocking you in front of other people and calling you worthless. And that experience on a daily basis is going to take a horrific toll on your mental health. Gaslighting within a coercive control framework, to me, feels like the most abusive form of gaslighting, because there's literally almost no way to get a sense of reality. The unwillingness of the world to recognize psychological abuse as being as damaging as physical abuse means that people experiencing this kind of pattern have very few places to turn. They are so often doubted that other than domestic violence programs that are informed about this dynamic, there is so little support. Anyone in a narcissistic relationship, though, all of you, you know the drill. People telling you, oh God, it can't be that bad. He's a big shot in the community. I mean, at least you have a nice house. I mean, gosh, at least he always cares where you are. My guy doesn't even care where I'm at. Or people telling you, relationships are hard. It's all of this gaslighting we get from the world on a regular basis that makes this so hard. Now, the dynamic of coercive control appears to a greater or lesser degree in nearly all relationships with malignant narcissists. In some cases, it may be milder. But these relationships are, by definition, manipulative, exploitative, menacing, confusing, and isolating. The coercive control dynamic can feel even more horrific when the malignant narcissist is charming and confident and charismatic and generous with other people. In that way, they're able to convince other people that he's a great guy. And that leaves you with even less of a likelihood of getting any support. In fact, as you get shredded by this relationship and seem less and less like yourself, others may even go so far as to feel bad for your abuser, because you aren't looking that good and anymore, and you're not that well put together, and how nice of him to stay with you. It's a mind F word all around. But malignant narcissistic types are not the only narcissistic types who are at risk for perpetrating coercive control, even though they're the most likely. This is a pattern that may also be observed in covert narcissistic patterns. The tendency of covert narcissists towards isolation, anyhow, means that they may try to suck you into their isolated universe. And they are also prone to dynamics such as control to keep a partner around. In both covert and malignant narcissism, we often also see people who hold and espouse ridiculous and dangerous views on women in relationships and nonsense about how women need to be obedient. Now, if you grew up in a family in which a coercive control dynamic occurred, it will have an impact on you as an adult. These impacts may range from severe anxiety to post-traumatic stress to regulation issues such as substance abuse. It is incredibly traumatic to grow up this way and to witness a parent being controlled in such a manner and living under the specter of the menace, because coercive controllers also tend to take it out on their children. Now, in the workplace, this dynamic may be less likely. However, if you are in a workplace situation in which you are vulnerable for reasons of things like legal paperwork, like, for example, immigration reasons, or you're in a coercive labor situation, or in a new culture where you may not be as familiar with languages or rules, or a person, for example, who's in a labor trafficking situation, coercive control often can and does show up with all of the same harms and risks, including things like indentured wages, having to pay money back to somebody for transporting you into that situation, and having no recourse, such as labor laws. Or if it's a residential situation where you live, where you work, these abuses can leave you isolated, and your communications may be monitored by your employer and other tools that you could use to get out, such as cell phones or passports, taken away. Now, control is consistently a part of the narcissistic relationship dynamic, and it tends to be an element in all of these kinds of relationships. However, when this control is at the level of coercive control, there is no mincing it. It is abuse. There is no excusal, and hopefully someday more and more regions of this of the world are going to recognize this as the rule of law. For now, I'm not holding my breath. But to talk about coercive control and not talk about narcissism misses the picture. And as always, we know these patterns don't change, especially when they are this severe. So a person in this situation is in danger, often grave danger. And this can be psychologically, physically, and quite often, it's both. If you do want to take a deeper dive into coercive control, because it's a very complex topic, please consider looking at Evan Stark's book. It's called Coercive Control, How Men Entrap Women in Personal Life. You know, I was on the fence about bringing this term of coercive control into the glossary. And as I was reading more about it recently, I recognize that coercive control really comes down to being, honestly, like a bit of a summary of what happens in many relationships with malignant narcissists. Now, please note, if in the United States, if you are experiencing abuse, please contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800.
If we fully gave up on ourselves, and we do give up on ourselves in these relationships and deny our every need, want, hope, belief, thought, perception, experience, and our identity, we still can't get this right because we cannot read their minds because it's impossible.
So let's set the scene. You're at a birthday party for a friend. Many people are paying attention to somebody who is talking about someone or something, I should say, that's really interesting that they recently did and that resulted in some public acclaim for them. So a whole group of people really sort of leaning in, and the story is quite interesting. And the narcissist is also listening and getting increasingly uncomfortable. You can see them sort of stirring in their seat, kind of checking their phone, yawning, kind of staring away. They may even get up and walk around, despite everyone else sitting down and being really engaged in the story. Maybe the narcissistic person will wander back to the conversation and say something like, "Really? Are we still listening to this yawner of a story?" Maybe they'll say something passive-aggressive. about the person who's talking or the topic. The narcissistic person may even interrupt and say, "Hey, who wants another round of drinks?" Perhaps the narcissistic person will interrupt and say, "Yeah, it's interesting you're talking about this award. I know the guy who got this award last year. Like, we did this project together." And then the narcissist may even succeed in hijacking the conversation. This is a classical red flag, but many of us, when we encounter, we write it off to other things. And this is a red flag that has a few parts to it. Not only do narcissistic people not like it when they are not the center of attention, they also don't like it when others are the center of attention. And they get visibly uncomfortable. And then lots of different things can happen. So this red flag can show up in a few different ways. So let me break those down for you. First, the narcissistic person may become sullen, sulky, and sort of disconnected. That most often manifests as them sort of, like I said, fooling with their phone or sometimes with them stepping away. And if you are in a public place, they may even start a conversation with other people who are in that same place that have nothing to do with your group. Many times this makes other people uncomfortable that the narcissist is sort of broken off. So they will try hard and work hard to try to draw the narcissist back into the conversation because the narcissist sort of seems so glum and victimized and kind of left out. The second thing to look for in this red flag is that the narcissistic person may start making jokes or disparaging the experience of the person who is the center of attention, and particularly at the expense of the person who may be the center of attention. As an example, think of a scenario where the conversation is focused on someone, I don't know, who just got a new job or a new position at a prestigious place, like a prestigious company or agency or university. And people are congratulating them and asking them about it, saying, "Wow, you just got a job at such and such. That's amazing." Well, obviously, this will activate all kinds of shame and inadequacy for the narcissistic person, especially if the narcissistic person is not where they want to be in their lives. And they may then start disparaging and joking and, "Ugh, well, that place where you got that job, gosh, it sounds like a place where being uptight is a way of life." Or they might say something like, "Oh, that's interesting you got that teaching position. Isn't it true that those who can't do teach?" Or they might say something like, "Yikes, I wouldn't want to move there. I must."
And you see how it is. You see how it is with many of the friendships that we keep and the people that we keep in our lives. How many people actually say things like that? So you decide that you're going to go for job interviews and you're going to apply for jobs, right? Especially for the graduates, right? You're applying for jobs and you are at this point, you just want to get into the workforce. You are not saying that, "No, I want to work for Alexander Forbes. You know, I want to work for Eagle FM." It's not like that. You know, you're like, "I'm going to apply for Eagle FM, but I'm also going to apply for the whole latter, you know, because I just need to get a job." And then the narcissistic person, maybe you have a narcissist in your friend group. The narcissistic person would most probably say things like, "Yeah. But, so you got a job at Kemanya. Isn't it that those people, but it's okay. So you got a teaching job. You know, the struggle is real. So you guys must just settle for whatever." Those types of sayings are not cool. And you might play it off because you're like, "Yeah, but it's my brother or it's my cousin or it's my friend or it's my boyfriend or it's my girlfriend that's saying this." But the truth is that there's no goodness that comes out of this. And it's only you that can identify it because it stings. It makes you feel some kind of way and it brings you a little bit of shame, especially if the person that is talking like that is a nobody. And even if they are a somebody, they feel like they are a nobody, so they try by all means to break everybody else down. And you should be able to identify this so that you can get away from this person sooner than later, because hey, omwenyo,
must be real nice to live with no culture other than our country fair. If the person who is the center of attention is graceful, they may try to roll with it. But the discomfort will be felt by others, people who are listening to the conversation. Others may uncomfortably laugh along. Third, a narcissistic person may try to hijack the conversation from the center person at the center of attention. And the narcissistic person will try to weigh in with their expertise or experiences. I've seen this happen many times when the person who...
And we call it the me syndrome. Huh? You are talking about, oh my goodness, I'm so excited. I finally got a job. And then somebody's like, yeah, I remember how I was excited when I got a job. You know, it was my first job. And I was like, then they go into a whole story about them. And then it just kind of overshadows you and you don't exist anymore. But it was your moment to shine. And they take center stage in everything. And not unless somebody can rear the conversation back to you, right? Then your moment of glory is gone because they want to shine the whole entire limelight on them. It's the Mimi syndrome that I talk about. That Mimi syndrome comes from narcissism. Eh? I'm just saying.
Who's getting the attention, maybe sharing.
It's me and Dr. Ramani today. Hey!
A story about an experience they've had, especially when it's sort of a more unique experience, like a travel or an adventure or an accomplishment, or maybe, you know, having an interesting kind of a conversation with someone who's known for something. That's all a little bit too much for a narcissistic person who always has to have the better story. So let's say, for example, the person who is currently getting the attention in a conversation, I don't know, they're talking about a recent work trip to a unique part of the world where they were doing some really interesting, groundbreaking, and kind of cool work. The narcissistic person, uncomfortable about not being the center of attention, may talk about that they've been there too. Yeah, I went there and I stayed there and I did that, or they've done similar kinds of work, or anything that makes their story better. And then they get the attention and control of the conversation. A fourth way this red flag could show up is that the narcissistic person may contradict the person who is the center of attention. They may say things like, well, that isn't true. Actually, that hotel you're staying, you say that's actually been closed for a while, or that university doesn't have that major, or yeah, I think you said you got that car. Well, that car wasn't made that year. And they will kind of go into petty fat checking mode again.
Petty facts, like have you ever met somebody where you say something like, yeah, I think Strandfontein hotel or lodge is just on the side of the beach, and so it's close to the ocean, so it might not be directly close to the ocean, but it might just be maybe a 5-minute walk, right? And a normal person would just take this up and be like, yeah, it's like, yeah, I heard it has great views. And we start talking about the hotel. This type of person is the type of person that will go and look for the distance from the beach to Strand, whatever hotel, right? And then they'll come back to you to come and tell you that what you said there was wrong and it is not actually correct, because here it is. Here is the real facts about this that you are saying. So you are wrong. It's like, it's so irritating. To be honest, it's so irritating to be around a person like that. Like, oh no, check this. Like, yeah. You said that Reboost only comes in 10 colors, so there's an 11th color. Like, but who cares? Like, how?
Again, it's often really cringy when they do this, but unless the person who is at the center of the conversation wants to get into an argument, and maybe they will, the conversation may then end with a new topic or something focused on the narcissist, or people just made uncomfortable by the whole way that conversation kind of went off the rails. A fifth way this red flag shows up is that the narcissistic person may just get passive aggressive if they're not the center of attention. They may say things like, yeah, sure, I get it. It makes more sense to let a person who is new in this industry to tell us about it. Yeah, I guess things have changed. When I started in the industry 25 years ago, expertise doesn't matter with all these new ways of doing things. So yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Youth before expertise. And they'll say it all with this look on their face that makes you wonder if they're having gas or some other gastric experience. It all of this just turns the attention on them. And they also show this contempt for the person speaking, and it shifts the entire conversational experience. Six, the way this red flag can show up is the sort of classical non sequitur. The narcissistic person literally just starts talking about something unrelated to what others are talking about. They make it about something they understand. They make the conversation about something they know about or care about. So a person may be talking about their child's experience, for example, in a math class, and the narcissistic person may not care. So we'll then just say, yikes, math class, who needs it? But has anyone tasted these appetizers? I've been eating at the restaurant that catered this party for years. I know the owner, and these are the best, and paired with this wine. Oh, this wine, I've been to this vineyard. I know the owner. And just like that, you go from some story about some kid in a math class, and now you're talking about crostini and wine. Seventh way this red flag shows up is contempt. This can show as groans and sighs and body language and like very contemptuous. Okay. Unless the person talking really wants to get into it with the narcissist, all of that body language may end the conversation. And many people just sort of cede the floor to the narcissist because they don't want to be on the receiving end of that contempt and may just sort of walk away from the conversation themselves. This experience of being made, this experience of being uncomfortable when the narcissist is not the center of attention is a pattern we observe in people who are narcissistic, and also, interestingly, in another personality pattern that's called a histrionic personality pattern. I hate the name, but that's what it's called. That histrionic pattern is about having shallow emotions, needing to be the center of attention, and being uncomfortable when not the center of attention. Histrionic personality is a sort of narcissism light. Some people have called this red flag of narcissists being uncomfortable when they're not the center of attention something called conversational narcissism. The need to take conversations over and make them sources of validation and make every conversation about themselves. It's a great red flag to be aware of because, again, it shows up early. I know, and some of you may be thinking that in some cases, this need to sort of make a conversation more relevant to you could be about social anxiety. People trying to talk about things they know about just to get a toehold into the conversation. But when it's social anxiety, you're not going to see the passive aggressive stuff, the contempt stuff, and the contradiction stuff. You will see more of the, oh yeah, I've been there too. I stayed there. And an attempt to nervously fit in to the conversation. So watch for this red flag. It is common. It shows up early. It's uncomfortable to witness. And if you pay attention to it and use it as a sign to say, okay, this person, I think I'm going to probably participate in them from a distance and set up some boundaries early, or maybe just disengage from the relationship, you can avoid a world of hurt. So trauma bonds are created by the alternation of bad and good, a good day and a bad day, idealization and devaluation. Sometime back on my podcast, the actress and writer Rebecca Humphreys, she said it the most beautifully when she said in the narcissistic relationship she was in, it was like getting pushed off a 100-story building, and then the narcissist manages to be the one to catch you just as you are about to hit the ground. So they are not just your abuser, they also become your savior. And that is how trauma bonds get created and reinforced. It only works if we have some attachment and desire. And the desire has to be for the relationship to work. And since these trauma bonds are with people we love, with family members or partners, people we care about, we get caught in this toxic dance that can keep us stuck in perpetuity. So let's take Rebecca's analogy that one thing that can happen often in toxic relationships is that they devalue, they demean, they insult, they argue.
And once they feel better, it's almost like they've let it all out, then they go in for the hug. Let me give you an example of how this can look. Let's say it's a situation where they can't find their keys and they believe that you moved them. They say, "Hey, where are my keys? Seriously, where are my keys?" You may respond, "I don't know. I haven't seen them today." They say, "Yes, yes, you have. You've seen my keys. You had to have seen them. I came home and I put them here, and you always move my stuff. You are so damn disorganized. Look at this mess. You don't put stuff away. I am so sick of it. You have ruined my day. I need to go out in 10 minutes to go pick up that stuff. And if I don't do it, then my entire day is going to be messed up. How could you do this to me? How could you mess with my keys?" Now, imagine they're sort of saying this relatively loudly, like I was trying to show, and you really, really did not touch their keys. Some of you may go and try to look for the keys. Others of you may be having a freeze response and just sort of stuck. Some of you may fight back. But most of you will not feel well at this point. There'll be more yelling. They're trying to find them. They're still yelling. Then they say, "To hell with it. I am taking your car. Too bad if you need it." And they grab their coat and they put it on, and voila, their car keys are in their pocket. They feel that pocket. They hear the jingle and they say, "Got them." And then, "I'm heading out. No apology." But as they're about to head out, and this is the part that's not okay, they may come in for a hug. They'll say, "Okay, come on, let's make up." And they'll come in for the hug or the kiss. You, meanwhile, at this point, may feel once again sick, exhausted, depleted, scared, or triggered. But they want to snuggle or have a kiss, and "let's make up" makes no sense because they were the ones screaming at you for something you didn't do. So it was largely a one-sided argument, if you even want to call it an argument, because there was no other side to it. Let me give you another scenario. You have an argument with them. They yell and they insult and they invalidate and they scream and they may storm off or leave. And then when you see them later, they come home in a good mood and they just want to snuggle. So this pairing of physical affection, when you have not had the opportunity to process the harms of what they have done, is not good for you. I'm not even sure if you process it, it's good for you. It feels intrusive and uncomfortable. And if you try to push them away or freeze up or don't respond, they're going to tell you that you're difficult and unforgiving. But at a somatic level, to have the person who just psychologically harmed you then try to touch you in a soothing or intimate manner, for lack of a better way to say it, it feels kind of gross. And once again, you may feel as though there's no response you're allowed to have, because if you push back or don't respond to them, it all starts again. It's always important to remember that narcissistic folks use conflict to regulate. The yelling and the screaming and the abuse allow them to reassert their power. And as they shatter you, they feel better. So after they feel better, and that coupled with their lack of empathy, then as far as they're concerned, everything's fine. And they come in for the hug, or they just assume that you want to snuggle because the argument's done. And they play upon the self-blame and your self-doubt, because when you push back or say, like, "I'm not hugging you, we're going to have to talk about this more," or you just say it doesn't feel okay, then you become the bad person who can't let go of stuff. It feels very violating when someone swoops in for a hug or a snuggle or a kiss after they have harmed you, and there has not been a period of time for you to talk it out or work it through. Everything is on their time frame. And the more that happens, the worse it feels. Things in this kind of relationship feel like they are happening to you and not with you. You are basically relegated to being an object, a sort of adult pacifier that they use to regulate. And when they are done with the yelling, they will want to regulate by being held. It's really not much different than a tantruming toddler that screams and cries and just starts yelling in the middle of a store, and then they need a hug from the parent afterwards. But there's a big difference that toddler is 3, not 53. But many people are confused and really put off and confused by this dynamic. It definitely is something that reinforces, as you can imagine, the trauma bond. And it can also reinforce the sense that somehow you're the one who's closed off, you're the one who's mean, you're the one who's cold or unforgiving if you don't just go with it. It's not true, but it's an absolute catch-22, because there's no way you can talk about it with them to share your feelings. And then there is the stuckness, and that tees up the self-blame. The key is to understand this dynamic so you can at least start to identify it and slowly maybe even break out of some of the self-blame cycles as well as the self-doubt, because you're not going to really be able to fix the situation. Therapy can be a place to address the feelings that a dynamic like this brings up. But when someone goes from rage to affection, it's very normal to not want to hug back. In fact, almost feel disgusted at the idea of hugging back. It's not you being closed off or distant or holding a grudge. It's that other person of not having empathy or absolutely no awareness of how their behavior is affecting you. So if that dynamic happens to you, be aware it is quite harmful. It reinforces the trauma bond. And when they simultaneously put themselves in this position as tyrant and tormentor and lover and hugger and carer of perpetrator and then savior, there's really no winning at that game. And it really helps you understand why this relationship is not only so difficult to remain sort of sane in, but even more difficult if you want to get out of. Okay, so let's talk about mind reading, which is such a central part of narcissistic relationships. The paradox of narcissistic relationships is that the person who is experiencing the narcissistic behavior often blames themselves for being selfish or narcissistic. And the narcissistic person largely whines and complains about how they are being mistreated. So let's talk about a fundamental way that this shows up, and one of the impossible corners of the narcissistic relationship. Here is the thing that just almost never happens in a narcissistic relationship. You are never clearly or accurately seen as a separate human being. You simply aren't. Your feelings, experiences, perceptions, beliefs, needs, physical condition, concerns as a separate human being are simply not registered. And that is a weird sort of Twilight Zone thing to get your head around. You are standing in front of someone, of another human being. You're standing in front of them crying or in pain or sad, or having gone through something. And it is a crapshoot whether or not it will be noticed or empathized with or even observed if you are standing in front of a narcissistic person. And then if it is noticed and registered, then it's yet another crapshoot if it will be regarded with kindness or assistance, or you will be dismissed as being ridiculous or an inconvenience. And what is messed up is this can vary. So there may be a day that you are crying, and someday the narcissistic person may offer some soothing words or a tissue or tell you that they understand why you are crying. And then the next time you're crying, they may roll their eyes and tell you that you're being ridiculous and too sensitive and have no right to feel that way. That is every narcissistic relationship. And because you love or care about or trust or believe you have to believe in this person, for example, it's a family member, you internalize all of these inconsistent ways they show up, and you tell yourself that you are reading the situation wrong. The thing that everyone craves in a narcissistic relationship and never gets, again, like I said, is simply to be seen as a separate human being. Whether that narcissistic person was your parent, in childhood and adolescence, or a partner, a sibling, a parent in adulthood, and especially in those key kinds of relationships we have. We just want to be seen. Maybe not even necessarily told we are right or great or even good, but just to be accurately experienced. The word for that is attunement, and it is a natural human need. We are built for it. Human babies need to see their caregiver's face staring at them a lot. In fact, the standard feeding position for an infant, if you're holding them right, is the ideal orientation of the caregiver's face to the baby's face. They need that to foster attachment and to be seen. And it goes from there. When we are adequately and consistently attuned to by someone else, over time we learn to trust ourselves. We build an emotional vocabulary. We have the freedom to develop an identity. And in the best version of this story, we learn that maybe everything we do isn't right, because nobody's perfect, but that we are a human being worthy of being seen and experienced and loved, and that we don't need to become something else other than ourselves for that to happen. Well, that is never going to happen in a narcissistic relationship, because again, we are objects to them that exist to do stuff for them. I'm not going to belabor that point. I've already said it 1,000 times. And heaven knows we can spend literal lifetimes wanting to be seen, right up to the deathbed hope that the narcissistic person will finally get it, and it isn't going to happen. But we get this hope we have of attunement, confused with something that the narcissistic person expects. And then we judge ourselves, wondering if maybe we are behaving as insanely and inconsiderately as them. You may believe that expecting to be attuned to is too much to ask, and that you are even being a bit extra for wanting it. Attunement, folks, is sort of a baseline fundamental human expectation. And interestingly, one of the pieces of human history that will go down is the day that these stupid devices came into our lives. And not just phones and tablets, but even the computer as a place where we manage everything from schedules to information, all of it. That was the moment when all those daily moments of attunement, a person sitting and looking at us during a simple interaction during the day, disappeared. So we've lost a lot of attunement in the last 20 years. Attunement goes from a basic human experience to what can sometimes feel like a luxury, especially for people who have multiple narcissistic relationships in their lives. And all of this is in contrast to what the narcissistic person expects, who doesn't just want attunement. Because you may be sitting here thinking, well, attunement is a very me, want and desire. And you may wonder, maybe it's narcissistic to expect someone to be attuned to you. But actually, what a narcissistic person wants is not limited to attunement. They want something more. Yes, they expect the attunement. They do expect everything to be focused on them, to be about them. And if it's not about them, they will click out. But they want something more. And what they want is for you to read their mind. Literally anticipate what they want. It's not just attunement, which is when someone comes to us, we do lift our head long enough to hear them and see them and listen to them and recognize them as someone with a separate reality and experience from ours. And that's not okay. Nope. The narcissistic person isn't going to do that. But they actually want you to read their minds, literally, to anticipate what they want, when they want, before they even say it, to anticipate that they're in a good mood, to anticipate when they want to be left alone, to anticipate when they want to have a chat, to anticipate when they didn't want fish for dinner, that you assumed that you knew that they wanted the delivery to be placed in the kitchen, to have made the appointment at the time they wanted, that they didn't share with you, by the way, they expect you to read their minds. And anything less doesn't work. And the messed up part is that we actually try to do it. When the gaslighting is full tilt in these relationships and we are all the way in the narcissistic system, and this really happens a lot with children who have narcissistic parents, we actually believe that we can do this, that we can anticipate their every need, say the right thing, keep the house organized the right way, bring the right gift, cook the right meal, have the right interests, do the right hobbies, avoid saying the wrong thing, have the right feeling, not express the wrong feeling. You get the idea. Every one of us who has ever had at least one narcissistic relationship in our lives, we tried this. And frankly, if we fully gave up on ourselves, and we do give up on ourselves in these relationships and deny our every need, want, hope, belief, thought, perception, experience, and our identity, we still can't get this right because we cannot read their minds because it's impossible. Infants, baby humans, through about their first year of life, they expect mind reading too. Even a little into their second year. That's why babies cry. But the other reason they cry is they don't have words. It has been argued that the baby doesn't understand that there's a difference between them and that nice person who shows up and feeds and holds them. They don't understand that differentiated, like, I'm different than this. So when that nice person isn't doing exactly what they want at the moment they need it, they yell. And over time, as they develop, and if we get it right enough with them and their little brains develop, they start to realize, oh, it doesn't work this way. And that milk person is separate from me and isn't always available. So I'm going to have to figure some of this out for myself and use my words. And then over time, one day we tie our shoes and we do use our words and we make our beds. The narcissistic person's psyche kind of gets stuck at that infantile phase. Read my mind. And if we don't, they wail and scream because we didn't. And until we do, it's not okay. And all of this is much cuter from a baby than from a 45-year-old man. You aren't asking for the narcissistic people in your life to read your mind. You're hoping for basic attunement. And there's a massive difference. Attunement is natural and human and expectable. If you get used to living without it for long enough, you may start to believe that attunement is rare. And it starts to take a toll on you when you don't get it. You may also start to believe there's something wrong with you, so that's why you don't get attuned to and it's your fault, or that you're narcissistic for expecting people to be attuned to you. No, attunement is sort of fundamental. It's the core of healthy parenting. And frankly, it's the core of any close, intimate, connected relationship. Mind reading, on the other hand, that's subjugation. It's to be expected or even required to be a mind reader. A person in such a relationship is locked into servitude, existing for another person and more attuned and aware into understanding that other person than they are for themselves. And that reversal, being there completely for the other person and not at all for the self, that is the core dynamic of the narcissistic relationship. It's the only way it can work. And sadly, for example, many a narcissistic boss expects this of their staff and employees. Narcissistic parents expect this of their children. Things like, you should know that daddy had a bad day and you should have been quiet. Narcissistic parents expect this of their spouses and partners. Narcissistic family members expect this of their other family members. Narcissistic friends expect this of their friends and convince us that it's actually possible to read their minds and that if we don't do it, then maybe we don't love them. Maybe we don't care. Maybe we aren't committed. Maybe we're selfish. narcissistic cult leaders, I mean, of course, is there any other kind, but narcissistic cult leaders do this to their audiences all the time. You can't read my mind? Well, you must not be committed to the cause. Wanting attunement is healthy and normal. Wanting someone to read your mind is not. And when you ask for or hope for attunement, you aren't asking for mind reading. Don't confuse the unrealistic and dehumanizing demands of the narcissistic relationship with your innate drive for a healthy connection with another human being. Stay in enough narcissistic relationships, or if you get raised by a narcissistic parent, and then you will believe that wants and needs that you may have, such as attunement on your side, are selfish, and yet their want for mind reading is somehow possible. Double standards and hypocrisy are the glue of narcissistic relationships. Everyone deserves to be seen as a separate human being. Everyone. Babies, within a year or two, grow out of the primitive idea that mind reading is a thing. But unfortunately, narcissistic folks don't. Let's talk about the tests of narcissistic loyalty. If you are from a narcissistic family system, then you know this in your bones. There is almost like a gang code level of loyalty that is expected in narcissistic family systems. And this expectation of loyalty actually sets up people for most of the harm that comes out of these relationships. But it's not specific to families or systems, though it can feel more intense there because there's more people demanding it. But I'm sure any of you have been through these relationships, you know this. Narcissistic people expect almost distorted levels of loyalty. And this can often be a major driver of the self-blame and moral injury that often happens for people in these relationships. Depending on the relationship, this can show up in different ways. In families is where we observe this whole loyalty thing, and we see it most pointedly. The, I don't know, fill in the last name, the Jones family, they stick together, which is really code for there are a few people in this family that do terrible things and may do terrible things to you, and you don't get to say anything about it, or you're being disloyal because we stick together. It brings up the illusion of the family, and blood is thicker than water, and we're all going to band together. And it brands this whole lack of protection and this place where you have to endure invalidation and mistreatment and keep your mouth shut as part of family loyalty. Like, that's the concept. And by just having to stay in an unsafe place, you then start framing your uncomfortable feeling as you being disloyal. And if you were to push it, to keep bringing it up, keep raising the problems in this family system, then you're the problem because, well, look how disloyal you are to keep making a fuss about this family. This whole disloyalty within the narcissistic family system plays on very fundamental human fears, such as ostracism and alienation and isolation. Every human being wants to belong to something, with rare exceptions, even if that belonging is to a dysfunctional family system. And again, there is no way to safely navigate this if you're a child. A child cannot afford to lose the support of the family. So to be marked as disloyal, as defying the tribe, as it were, that is something no child can hold up under. Kids may cave, and frankly, depending on how severe the trauma or abuse or adversity or whatever it is that child is having to pretend isn't happening, this is the start of other more significant patterns for a child, such as complex trauma reactions, dissociation, and obviously lots of self-blame in the form of, I'm the bad one. And all the more this gets worse if the child believes or is being made to feel that they're being disloyal. Some families may even have scary stories that they tell about people from the family who were so terrible as to be disloyal, like, we don't speak to Uncle Charlie so much, or we don't speak to Cousin Susie so much anymore, because they weren't loyal. Or there will be legends of those who were shut out of the family because of their lack of loyalty. Again, the younger you, when you're exposed to this mythology, it's really harmful because it creates this real fear of being left out in the cold with no support. The idea of poor Uncle such and such wandering the world without a family because he is disloyal is a lot. But you now know that Uncle such and such was probably ahead of his time and may now be living his best life because he has nothing to do with this family. Now, in intimate relationships, loyalty or lack of loyalty is, or the being branded as disloyal is often used to isolate people. There is an assumption in some, not all, but some, many narcissistic relationships that you have to be all in, that the relationship has to be the most important thing in the world. That, for example, choosing a night out with friends to celebrate someone's birthday or go away on a weekend with old friends or even choose to spend time with family is labeled as disloyal, a sort of retrograde positioning of, well, you're in a relationship now. This should be the most important thing for you. So having any kind of meaningful life or relationships that are separate in any way from the relationship can then be viewed as a betrayal of sorts by the narcissistic person you're in a relationship with and a sort of statement on your lack of loyalty. And this can feel really messed up when in fact the narcissistic person has betrayed you in the past and yet they are calling you out on your lack of loyalty. I mean, hypocrisy is one of the love languages of the narcissistic relationship. Your lack of loyalty in an intimate relationship may also kind of come up or be brought up to you if you may agree with someone else, which may mean then you're not agreeing with your narcissistic partner, right? You agree with someone else's opinion. You don't agree with the narcissistic person. Your narcissistic partner may then view you as taking sides and not being loyal. And this can really sting if you actually do value yourself as being a loyal person. And as someone who really hasn't betrayed the narcissistic person, but you keep getting this disloyal label thrown on you. In friendships, again, we can see a similar pattern. The narcissistic friend may view you as disloyal for branching into other friend groups or not pulling them into a new group of people that you've met. A narcissistic friend, again, may do what they want when they want, but still feel as though they have some sort of control over who you socialize with and how you socialize. Again, there's that hypocrisy. And especially if this is an old friend you've had for a very long time, there may be a tendency for them to take the stance of, oh, I've known you forever and you chose them. You're so disloyal. You can sort of feel stuck. It's as though you have to choose the high school or childhood or college friend who has been around for a long time and feel a loyalty to them, but also that you can't branch out into new friendship groups or interest groups without the old narcissistic friend's permission, without them coming along. And remember, narcissistic friendships can be very difficult to wriggle out of, especially because of things like guilt and pity. Then, of course, there is the workplace, where loyalty is already kind of touted as a workplace value. But in a narcissistic workplace, it may be positioned as, if you question something, such as a bad policy or an unfair policy, that you're being disloyal. If you don't pitch in more than you're being paid for, you're being disloyal. If you consider looking for another job or a better job, or a job with more opportunity, then you are being disloyal. Disloyalty accusations can be a way to control folks, gaslight them about their commitment to the job, or even imply a lack of commitment that would then make you less desirable for a promotion in that kind of an organization. And in really narcissistic workplaces, anything you may do to have some kind of balance in your life but doesn't always put work as the priority for you, is often branded by narcissistic bosses and managers as you being disloyal. And it's interesting because this is coming up more and more with shifts in the workplace. Folks who don't want to have to come into the office all the time and can get some of their job done at a remote site are now being hit with disloyalty accusations and about not being on board with the team and the workplace community because you want to continue sort of a hybrid work arrangement. Now, these accusations of disloyalty, they come from a few places. I'd say, first of all, they come from good old entitlement on the part of the narcissistic person. Narcissistic people sort of feel entitled to all of you, your time, your thoughts, your life. So if you attempt to exert yourself as something separate for them, well, then you're being disloyal to them. In addition, narcissistic people do not take responsibility or accountability, and they'll often project blame for their bad behavior onto other people. And so calling you disloyal for what they characterize as sort of breaking ranks, when all you are doing is maybe drawing their attention to something they did that was harmful, or something harmful that was happening in a relationship or a family or a workplace or a friend group, means not only do they not have to take responsibility, it's also a gaslight, because being accused of disloyalty when you are calling them out on a problem makes you the problem. And since enablers and other people who might be benefiting from or comfortable with the status quo of the system are often more interested, like I said, in keeping the system going than protecting people within it, the narcissistic folks often get to keep on keeping on, and you get to be viewed as disloyal. This accusation of disloyalty is a sort of tool for squelching individuation. How dare you be you? How dare you do something you want or need? Well, using that big disloyalty word there can shut that down. You're doing something for yourself. And it can keep people stunted and stuck in a version of themselves that works in the relationship or the system or for the narcissist, but it's not your true self. This whole disloyalty universe is often what keeps everyone in the system locked into limiting, stunted spaces until you finally get it and can make steps towards setting yourself free. In any kind of group system, call it what you will, workplaces, families, this whole loyalty thing can get really dark. And since in many systems, at least for some period of time, the narcissistic person is the one with a lot of the power, the narcissistic person is always going to reward the most loyal person, even if that loyalty means that in order to earn the narcissistic person's designation of you as loyal, you have to throw other people under the bus. Now, this can feel uniquely cruel in families, where you may, for example, share a confidence or a secret with a family member and even told them about something maybe that was hurting you. And instead of protecting you, they run to the narcissistic person so they can be the loyal one and stay in the glow and receive the indulgences of the narcissistic person. And so now the narcissistic person may view you as even more disloyal, and you have been harmed, and now you're being betrayed by someone in that system, family or workplace, that you may have thought that you could trust. And now that this issue, whatever it is, has been shared, the harm to you in the system may now even be worse. This volleying and jockeying for power and getting the narcissistic person to notice them is a core of triangulation. Everyone in the family or in the workplace kissing the proverbial ring, trading on anything to stay close to the narcissistic parent, the narcissistic patriarch, matriarch, whomever, getting that protection, being viewed as loyal, and magnifying the harms of the narcissistic person through the system. If you have ever been betrayed in this way, you know exactly what I'm talking about. A very similar dynamic shows up in narcissistic workplaces, where folks try to stay close to the narcissistic boss or leader and never speak against their policies, no matter how terrible or potentially harmful those policies are, throw people under the bus, even snitching on people. And in fact, narcissistic leaders and bosses will encourage people in the workforce to snitch and turn people in who may either be saying bad things about the narcissistic leader or are uncomfortable with the shifts in the workplace or not following policies to a T. And the minions and the enablers of the narcissistic leader or boss will then gleefully turn folks in to get the glow of the narcissistic person's whatever. And it feels very Orwellian. And these people who turn people in are, again, rewarded by the narcissistic boss, and everyone else is harmed, and fear can cut through the entire system. Everyone in these systems who gets to stay becomes a yes person. The narcissistic boss is well supplied, and these stories never end well. We are taught that loyal is good, that it's a virtue to stand by someone, to stand for a cause, a system, a country, whatever it is. Sadly, what we learn in narcissistic relationships is that loyalty is a one-sided commitment. It is often weaponized. It's used as a tool to keep people in line and to ostracize or silence them when they won't go along. And because belonging is such a universal need, others in the system who just want it to keep running and keep existing may pile on the bandwagon of viewing the person being labeled as disloyal as the problem instead of seeing the real source of it, the narcissistic person. It's tricky because since we are taught that loyalty is good and under the right circumstances, loyalty is good, and then we are then told that we are not loyal people by the narcissistic folks and their enablers, it just leaves us feeling like we are bad, disloyal people, and that, especially if it starts young, can become part of our identity. Narcissistic folks force this loyalty from families and colleagues and employees and make it part of the transaction of the relationship. And many a person has believed that they can win over or get on the good side of the narcissistic person through this absolutely overplayed loyalty. And people who do that will either go down with the ship if the narcissistic person ever goes down, and all that loyalty that the narcissistic person demanded from you will all be forgotten, because a narcissistic person has no problem with other people taking the fall for their sins. So basically, all that loyalty you had to the narcissist gets repaid with narcissistic betrayal. Or it could be that the loyal players are asked one day to do the thing they cannot do, the true test of loyalty. And this is a common play by more severely narcissistic and psychopathic people. In fact, it's a play often used in cultic systems. Loyalty is cemented by someone being willing to do something in utter violation of their own values. And the moral injury and self-disgust can pile up, especially if you do some of it. Or the person may finally say, I'm sorry, I can't do that. And then bam. All those years of loyalty down the toilet, just like that. The first time loyal you says no. It's all or nothing in the world of narcissistic loyalty, and they will keep moving those goalposts to the point where you're having to do things that you may never forgive yourself for. So part of healing is testing that sense of yourself as a disloyal person. Lots of folks who get out of narcissistic relationships and families and workplaces will say, I actually believed I was not a team player. I actually did believe that I was a disloyal person. And it can take a while to build that sense back up that in fact you were loyal, but that what was being asked of you wasn't about loyalty. It can also take a lot of time just to build back what a healthy sense of loyalty is. It's not one-sided. It's not supposed to be a test, and it's not meant to be a weapon. And it is not meant to be that loyalty is that you do things in violation of your values, ethics, or the law. If you do get roped into the sense of being loyal to a narcissist, you will get burned. And it can be a steep climb back up to a balanced, thoughtful, and reasonable sense of loyalty. But be careful of this entire framework of loyalty in a narcissistic relationship. Sometimes we're so focused on wanting to prove the narcissistic people wrong. Hell with you, I'm so loyal. But then you're almost playing into a trap, because in that case, loyalty often means sticking around or doing the things that don't feel right or giving into a structure that doesn't feel aligned with who you are. So it's a messy space, and many, many survivors can take years to get back to a place where they recognize that they are actually loyal, and that can really show up well for them in healthy systems. But that takes a minute. Thanks again.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you guys are enjoying our program this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, the number in studio is 083-288-401 as we dive into the world of the unknown, the world of the mind, the world of psychology, and as we get people to intertwine. Hello, hello.
Goeie nuus, Imba het nou nog beter geword. Ons het splinternuwe funksies bygevoeg om jou ervaring vinniger, beter en kragtiger te maak as ooit tevore. As jy gereed om die volle potensiaal van Imba te geniet, kry alle eksklusiewe funksies vir slegs $36 per maand of spaar selfs meer met ons spesiale intekenplanne. 5% afslag vir 'n 3 maande intekening, 10% afslag vir 'n 6 maande intekening en 25% afslag vir 'n 12 maande intekening. Kies die beste plan vir jou werk en geniet al die voordele wat Imba bied teen 'n onverbeterlike prys. Imba, waar die wêreld saamkom, laai dit af en teken vandag aan.
Alrighty, good evening to you, ladies and gentlemen. If you have just joined us, it is the Matriarch and we are diving into the world of money and relationships. And it's not just money and relationships, it's the world of control, it's the world of narcissism, it's the world of abusers, it's the world of, it is the dark, dark side of the world, it's the dark, dark side of the human mind. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the reason, right, that we are allowing conversations such as these ones to come and be a part of our table conversations is because we want to explore. Good evening.
Good evening,
I'm fine. You don't sound fine, but I'm great. Hi.
I'm fine.
Are you sure? What happened? It's adulting. What happened? Why do you sound like that?
No, I'm asleep. I dreamed. I slept, but it was not enough.
Uh-huh. So you would like to touch base on a little bit of sleep, a little bit extra sleep and whatnot. Mm. But as a Vambu girl, you can go and sleep when you're dead. Vambu girls don't rest.
Okay.
Eh, Vambu girls don't rest. You can't see your grandmother. Your grandmother is also participating there. It's maybe what keeps her young. So, yeah. You are born into it. So talk to me.
What's the next topic?
Ha, you were not listening.
No.
How do I even start? Okay, well, you can tell me. What is your thought on women having their own money before they get into relationships?
What are my
thoughts on women having their own money before they get into relationships?
Yeah.
Is that one? It's a tough one. What do you think about it? Should they have their own money or should they just eat the men's money?
No, they should have their own money.
Why?
They should have their own money because, okay, they say that their husband is a provider.
What is a provider?
A provider is a person, a provider is someone that provides for the family.
Okay. And a woman can't be a provider?
No, naturally husband is a provider.
According to which nature?
According to God, most.
According to God, did God put it in the commandments?
No, it was not in the commandments.
He just put it inside the Bible.
Just a moment, ma'am.
All right, it was a conversation about logbooks first, you know, sister. Sister is calling while she's on duty. What are we talking about? I just want to get away from sickness a little bit and then go and enjoy my mind. But we'll be waiting for your call, Aina. Ladies and gentlemen, the question is, should a woman have her own money when she's entering into a relationship and why? So, Aina was going with, the narrative of a man should be a provider, but, okay. Not bad, but what is a provider and what was a provider back in the day? Because I feel like we take what we want to take from the other generations and we leave everything else. Because were they really providers or were they forced laborers? Because like people were just forced to go and work, you know, people were forced to go and work. If they had a choice, they'll just stay home and, you know, fend for their families, take care of their families and be that as it may. So I don't know, with the concept of provider, maybe you guys have to come through and you guys have to come and let's have a debate on what a provider is in contemporary times, because I know that I don't see it. I think that everybody should just we should just work together to make sure that we don't mess up our kids. And we give them the best that we could and with whatever we were given. And that's it. So the number in studio is 083-288-401. That is 083-288-401. That is the number in studio. Come, let us have a debate. So we're talking about money and relationships and whether or not a woman should have her own money when entering into a relationship. And obviously, and of course, we are going to have a conversation. We're going to listen to a meaningful conversation about relationships, power, and managing money in as couples. And we're going to hear and we're going to listen, because that's what we have to do. Because some of these lessons, right? Sometimes we have to hear these lessons from somebody, that has, you know, worked in the CIA. Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes it is what it is. So ladies and gentlemen, please stay tuned and please don't shy away from calling when something interesting, comes up and you want to discuss it. Don't shy away. I'm just here. We are in tune with the conversation. Okay.
There is no relationship without power dynamic. That is not a dirty word for me. The minute you depend on someone, they have power.
How do we find the balance between what we talk about together versus what we treat as independent and individual money?
I think that the balance of togetherness and separateness is among the two, if not the most important tasks of a relationship. The making of a couple is that.
For a couple that's newly married, what advice would you have for them around money?
Don't wait till you divorce to find out.
Welcome back to Love and Other Assets. I am very excited today for our special episode where I'm going to be welcoming my husband and co-founder Channing and our advisor Esther Perel. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, we started Plenty after we began merging finances and saw what a mess that could be. We both worked in Silicon Valley for over a decade and we knew there had to be something better for today's couples. Today, Plenty is a wealth platform that makes it easy to invest, budget, and plan for your future together. Built for couples. Esther, let's see where this goes. He was very much like, I can get this. Let me get this one. And I remember making that decision. And that for me, I think changed some of the emotion around it too. Is, oh, okay, there's more than just friends here.
So say more. By allowing him to pay for me, it meant what? More than just it was more. What did it mean for you? Because what you instantly have highlighted is the connection between emotions and money.
Yep.
I mean, they are inseparable.
Yeah.
So what did it mean to allow him to take care of you? To allow, because that's what it was, right?
Yep.
To allow you to depend on him, owe him, be grateful to him. That instantly feels like, on the one hand, it's a loving gesture and it brings that feeling, but it also creates an instant power dynamic.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Okay. I still remember, because when I go out with friends, we're always very careful where we split the bill immediately. We, you know, we immediately send the Venmo. There's no owing. You know, it keeps very clean. When my mother was raising me, one of the things she used to talk to me about when we first started dating was to remember to treat any person that I'm seeing as someone's son. Don't, you know, take advantage. And so for dates, if I ever thought I wasn't going to see someone again, I would always split the bill. Right. But it was a very big deal if I let someone pay because I knew that there would be another
time. It meant you had feelings for them.
It meant I had feelings. Right. And I also planned to get it next time because there would be a next time, or I intended mm-hmm. for there to be a next time.
And do you remember that one?
I do remember. I was completely oblivious to everything that was going on, but I do remember the occasion.
But do you remember the transaction around money? Did you notice anything about that? Or for you, it was just, I can get this one. It's no big deal kind of thing. It's a bill.
It was pretty low key.
So at what point for you did a certain behavior together around money begin to mean a different weaving of a narrative between us? Because people typically ask, not did they pay, did you pay, did you share, did you... People usually ask, you know, did you sleep together? Did you mm-hmm. kiss? Did you... Mm-hmm. That's the things that people measure to see the progression of the relational story. And I think it's very interesting to actually... And equally true that the way that the transactions around money are translating feelings, weaving of a story that is on an emotional level between two people.
Yes, for me, that's certainly true.
Yeah, I would agree as well. I think something that you mentioned earlier, there are some little tests, I think, that come around money. And I tried to pay for everything, and Emily would push back and not let me pay for everything. And I learned to trust that she saw some level of equality there, that she didn't expect me to pay for everything in our relationship.
What does paying for everything... I know what letting him pay means.
Yeah.
What does paying means? I'm a gentleman. I'm upstanding.
Yeah, I can provide.
I've achieved something. Mm-hmm. I can all of the traditional.
Yeah, I think it means a lot of those things. And then at the same time, there's this reality that we're both earning income.
Mm-hmm.
I knew we were earning somewhat similar income. So to have just me pay for everything would have felt like maybe relying on traditional gender roles in a way that mm-hmm. I'm not sure I would have felt about that.
Was there a time when you suddenly shifted that? And it was no longer equal on the income level? And then what did that do?
Yes. Emily began making more than me at one point. And we didn't change our spending behavior then. We pretty much split things 50-50 by that point of our relationship.
So he helped me with the negotiation to get the raise that ended up meaning I did earn more. But it was a lot through his support and encouragement to ask for what, you know, he thought I was worth.
Mm-hmm. Would you consider that value contribution to the income of a household or of a couple? Is it he helped me?
Mm-hmm.
And because he was supportive, or is the person, maybe one person can do this job that is worth that amount of salary, but it's this one who knows how to make the negotiation. Do all of them belong to the pool of value contribution?
I think that was my first taste of it within our relationship, of it being really a team. And it really was through mm-hmm. his support, I was able to earn more to a degree that I don't think, you know, I'd ever really thought of it that way before. But I think even now, seeing, you know, when one person covers more things, maybe makes a dinner so the other person can work a little bit more, I do think that actually was probably the earliest version of that.
Right.
Which was supporting me in those negotiations and then making that actually possible to earn more.
So, I mean, one of the first words one needs to throw into the basket when you talk money in a relationship is fairness. How did you come to define fairness and then set it up?
I think the question really came up when we moved in together and began sharing the majority of our expenses. Because up till that point, it was easy to say, you know, I'll pay for this one, you pay for that one.
Mm-hmm.
When it became a material amount of our spending was shared, we really had to have those conversations. Mm-hmm. At first, when we were earning similarly, it was 50-50. That felt right. As it evolved and Emily earned more, we stayed 50-50. The conversation there was that our consumption was the same. So I wasn't spending more than I would have spent if Emily wasn't my partner. Therefore, it didn't feel right to have her pay more than I was paying. I think if I'd been living a different lifestyle because of Emily's income, we probably would have had a conversation about adjusting our shared contribution to expenses based on income versus based on 50-50.
But when you rented your first apartment together or whatever you rented, how did you negotiate that?
Well, we defined as moving in together. It was during the peak of COVID. And we actually...
That's when many people moved in together.
Yes, exactly. And at the time, I had 5 roommates and he had 2 roommates. And so we looked at the situation. We no longer had to go into an office. And we said, why are we here in San Francisco paying this amount of rent? So when we first started thinking about what was next, we made the decision actually to pack up all of our stuff, donate a bunch, put the rest of it into storage, and we traveled for almost 2 years. And we did talk about, you know, how much we thought was reasonable to put towards rent. But by and large, we were saving money by traveling together and leaving San Francisco. The amount that we were each spending on rent and food were fairly similar. So we didn't have that many differences. There were small things here and there for sure. But I think by and large, we had such similar numbers that it wasn't anything that really felt like it was a tension before we moved in.
So which was the first difficult conversation about money that you had?
I'll say the first difficult conversation was about other assets. And I was aware that Emily came to our partnership having worked at another tech company. So much of compensation in tech is equity in the companies that you worked for. And Emily had worked for a company that was very successful. So I knew we had different assets coming into the partnership. And I remember us sitting down actually in New York City and talking about what that meant for us. And it was a very uncomfortable conversation.
Because
it required a vulnerability about this paradox I had of wanting to embrace Emily's incredible abilities as a professional and everything she'd achieved and loving that, admiring that. And also feelings I was having come up around insecurity. What's it going to mean for me to have less assets than Emily? How is she going to see me? How do I see myself? How does society see me? And it was incredible how having the conversation where I acknowledged having some of these feelings come up and I'm not proud of them. I'm actually kind of embarrassed that I'm having these feelings in the first place. And Emily holding them and us having a conversation about it where even just taking that shadow and putting it out in front of us changed the way that it felt for me. Yeah.
But it's a shadow that is not just personal. Mm. It's all, I mean, you're talking about vast cultural legacies, about masculinity, about providers, about the role of a man, of a caregiver. And what's changed is that you think, how can I admire her and then have those feelings? I shouldn't have those feelings if I really admire her. When in fact, both are existing inside of you. And yes, it makes me like, then what is it? You know, if that's not the definitions of manhood and masculinity and achieving and responsibility and confidence, then what will it be? And can I experience it differently than in it making me more insecure? Can I experience it in, wow, it's an amazing partnership to be with someone who in a way takes away that enormous responsibility that men have had to carry for centuries. That doesn't mean they don't have to do anything. It just means that they don't have to do it alone. Because that's the main thing that men have often done. And then maybe I'll ask you first before I give the other side of this. Mm-hmm. So what was that one for you?
I think I remember that conversation really well. I think I have always been driven to do something with what I work on and my career. And I'd always had this fear that it would potentially be something that I need to hide or would be hard to face for a partner that I was with. And I
don't
think...
Don't outsmart him.
Exactly.
See, that exactly. There's a lot of, you know, archaic...
Yeah.
Cliches in lying underneath a lot of this. Yeah,
exactly. And I think, you know, family is so important and the future family and kids, that is very important to me. But in this chapter, my career is very important to me. And I think I was worried with how that would be received or misconstrued by someone. And I think when Channing first shared that with me, I felt so much safer in that it wouldn't be something that would catch me off guard down the road that he would have hidden, you know, for years and years and years. It was something that he was comfortable enough to talk about so we could address it. And for me, it didn't matter. I think if you look out into our lives and start to play out, okay, well, if we're together for 5 years, and what about 10 years or 15 years? The gap, the disappears pretty much. And so I hadn't really thought about it being, you know, something that I was concerned about, but I was really grateful. And I think it built a lot of trust to know that we could talk about it.
Yep. 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 What did you think of what I said before about not doing it all alone? Does that speak to you, or does that?
I think it speaks to me. I think it's the part of that conversation that spoke the most to me when I was able to clarify, we were able to talk about it, is which path do I want? Like, I love all the parts of Emily, and I love what she's capable of professionally. And I want to be a partner that supports my partner in giving everything she can back to the world and is supported in doing the same myself. And that comes into fundamental conflict with me then indulging an insecurity around how much money she makes or how many assets she has. Because if I indulge that, I won't be that supportive partner. So when we were able to put those two things out, it was so clear to me, this is the path that I want to go down. And it's made it much easier to walk down that path.
And after difficult conversations, have you had fights? She has one instinct.
What are you going to say?
I think I came from a family where we were always very thoughtful and probably more on the frugal side when it came to spending on food. And the memory that just came in mind was, I think even just last week, we had breakfast and, you know, we ordered, I think Channing ordered like an omelet. He added avocados and bacon, and that restaurant clearly made most of their money off of people adding. And so I think the additions were already more than 50% of what the omelet was. And I remember sitting there just being like, oh, okay, don't say anything. It's his own decision, but
made the omelet 100% better. So I think made sense, but
you didn't even notice it is the difference.
Yes.
And then the question for me is, you did not notice it because you've never had to? And you grew up with more means, or did it that you were taught to look, but you did have, but it didn't start its way. So now we're going into money and values and what's worth it and what is worth it to spend on. It's not how much you added. It's the fact that you were busy there watching him add. Whereas he was thinking, I'm improving on my omelet. That's a perfect example. Let's look back.
I think my family definitely thought about value from a how full are you afterwards too. That was definitely part of it.
But wait, the value was sustenance. Was the value sometimes abundance?
Quantity of food. Yes. You know, we would go more to the restaurants where they had larger portions because we thought that was a better value.
Was there a permission toward indulgence as it plays out around money?
Generally, it would happen when we did a family trip. The trip would be, we're not going to think
how
about
money.
How
many were you?
Four of us. So and my parents, were you? My brothers.
Five.
Five. Okay.
And we would think if we'd go on these trips, we usually do, you know, one bigger trip per year. And during that trip, normally during the year, we'd be thoughtful, you know, when we go out to eat and we'd be taught to know, look at the price, look at the receipt, look at the invoices. But when we were traveling, that was our, we don't travel all that often, get the dessert. We don't normally get dessert.
Did you review the bill?
Always.
Did you review the bill?
Yes.
You were taught to review the bill?
No, that's something I learned later.
How?
When I became responsible for my own money.
And you were taught to review the bill.
Right. My parents would hand us the check, actually, and have my brother and I double check the math.
It's the best way to learn, you know. And was there, here's a value. It's not needed. It's not necessary. You can do without. Was that a value?
My parents would probably cause more of like the self-control and the discipline. That was definitely valued. You know, being able to say, oh, I'm not going to do that. I'll save the money.
Did you also sometimes have, if it pleases you, go ahead?
I would say usually it was if they wanted to gift something, my family had a very big, well, I won't buy it for myself, but I'll buy it for you. So I think we saw indulgence with gifting like that, but very rarely for indulging for yourself.
Right. How about you?
I think it was less precise. We'd say, oh, that's too much money, that's too little money, but we wouldn't get into the details of exactly how much was the right amount for something. It was more of an arbitrary judgment that was passed down from our parents.
It's the right amount, but it comes with, you're allowed to spend on yourself, you're allowed to lavish yourself, you're allowed to spoil yourself, you're allowed to be abundant or to indulge. It's these words that kind of says other things are more important than how much it costs, which is exactly what happens when it's a gift you give to someone else. The gifting of something to someone else is more important than how much it costs. It's not the money. It's what's the value underneath that is being reinforced. And there is around money often an abundance mentality and a scarcity mentality, measured somehow around money, but it usually means something else. Food is okay. Travel is not. Books are okay. Food is not. Living in the moment is what matters. Who needs to save? You know, I could be dead tomorrow. I mean, it's endless how much the values around money become existential values, values around life, around love, around friendship, around giving, receiving, sharing. It's all embedded in there.
I mean, I think that's definitely a conflict that we see, you know, when couples are talking about how much are we saving versus how much are we spending right now? How much do we enjoy today versus we put aside for our future? And I think that is something, especially when you come from a family background where that's different, it makes those conversations much harder.
I mean, I went back to look at a series of questions around, but every question ended with, how can I bring this up? How can we talk about this without fighting? How can I not make my partner feel lousy? Or how can I not be made to feel lousy for bringing it up? I mean, it didn't really matter what the subject of the money actually was. Mm-hmm. In the end, the relational communications piece is what people were really asking the question about.
So what advice would you have for couples?
I thought if I looked at what were the questions, you know, in the end, what people were really asking were three things. How do I talk about this? Because it's a power issue. And I feel my partner is saving in too much control, or I don't want them to think I won't need this control, or I have a hard time relinquishing control. I've taken care of my money all alone myself forever. And now suddenly we need to do this together and I don't want to have to relinquish the control. So it had to do with power and control. Or it had to do with trust, care and closeness. You know, my partner has debts. How much is it my responsibility to pay for them? Or I have, I mean, debts is a major one in couples. Or we moved in together. How do I know that you moved in because you really love me and not just because it's convenient and it makes it cheaper? I mean, can it be a matter of the heart and not just a matter of the wallet? So that's the care and closeness piece. And then the third one had to do with respect and recognition. My partner has asked me to help them. They've already tried a few times to start a new business. How many more times do I have to continue to do this? I'm not sure. I really respect that this is their forte. Mm-hmm. Doesn't look like, or how do I know that it is, you know, that this is the way this works? And you can do this 6-7 times until suddenly, finally, something works. In the end, I looked at 12 different questions like this, and everything, 15, maybe even more, came down to these three dynamics. Those were the relational dynamics that defined what the conversation was actually about, or underneath anyway.
So
does that make sense? I mean, you're the ones who...
Yeah.
I put stuff out. You tell me, yes, we've seen that too, or no, this is not at all. But that's how I interpreted it.
I definitely think so. I think, you know, with the power and control, I think that comes out in a lot of the ways for how couples talk about what is our money? What is my money? Do we keep things private or not? Maybe the independence piece comes out because they're used to managing their own money for so long and it feels so scary to now be like, not only do you have the ability to see what I'm doing, you actually have a say in it. And that is a relinquishment in control too. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of couples where it used to happen at marriage where you would fully merge all of your finances, there's not that moment anymore for most couples today. And it's really more like there's baby steps. You might, even when you're dating, start to share a little bit more about where you are. When you get married, you might open up your first joint account, but it doesn't mean that you're using it for everything.
Or that you're giving up on your independent account.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, exactly. And I think for a lot of couples today, now, it's not as obvious, which I think both is because people are used to be more independent, but it makes it more complicated because it's not like there's an obvious one-size-fits-all best solution anymore in the same way.
No, I mean, I was mentioning it today on my way coming here. I come from a refugee family where my parents started out with nothing together. And therefore, it always was together. Mm-hmm. I've never known. In my mind, there was no such a thing as to be married and not have your entire finances joined. Until I came to the U.S. and I started to practice psychotherapy in New York and in Boston. Mm-hmm. And I was realizing that, no, not at all. I would find out because I didn't even ask at first because I assumed wrongly. And then I began to ask and I started to hear people say, no, no, we have everything separate. Mm-hmm. And so what he contributes this amount for the household and then the other one, he contributes that for the household. And it was a completely new reality. And I realized this is, A, it's older. Mm-hmm. People have already... Plus, they come with something. If you come with something, it's a very different story than what I grew up with. And the need to remain independent is extremely important, and it's defined in large part around money.
Over all the years, when you've had these couples in your therapy room, what are the different structures of managing money that you've heard of?
The most interesting one that I heard of was, that I learned from a couple, was the concept of value attribution. That to be a provider or what you make or what you bring wasn't just going to be measured in dollars, in bills. And that opened up a whole, like, this is not recent, but it totally changed my way of thinking. Because that same artist that wasn't necessarily earning much had just renovated the whole house. Hands, you know, nail by nail.
Yeah.
And that property had completely risen and changed in value because, and the quality of life had improved, that they were able to build a room for this and a shed and a whatever. And that was money. Mm-hmm. So that when the other partner came and said, my partner isn't providing, mm-hmm. he isn't putting bread on the table. Mm-hmm. I'm like, that is not how I see it. Have you considered that this whole renovation is a 1 year salary? If you hired someone to do this, this is how much you would be paying. That liberated me because what happens is that when people come and they're stuck, there's rigidity. It's you make, you don't make, it's fair, it's not fair. It's the money is not a thing around which people talk with subtlety. So I had to find other ways to suddenly shift and say, have you ever looked at it this way? And do a whole reframe and make people go like this, because that's when they stop. And instead of being reactive, they become curious. Mm-hmm. And they say, never looked at it like that. And that's what you want, right? So that was a major one. The amount of conversations I've sat where one person says to the other, you're spending too much. And the other says, but it's my money. Mm-hmm. Well, is it your money? Mm-hmm. What makes it your money? Just the fact that you are the one earning it? What about the money value of the person who stays at home to take care of everything that a home and a family needs taken care of, including kiddos, if there are such? That too has a money value. So this idea that there's a single household provider, that whole language I began to dismantle.
Mm-hmm.
So that we could really talk about the power dynamic and the money and what can afford and who decides and who is really bringing in and providing is a totally different story than just income bracket.
Is it possible to not have a power dynamic, or if it's inherent, is there a way to reduce it? Is that even a thing to want?
Well, but that I would answer this to you differently. There is no relationship without power dynamic. Mm-hmm. That is not a dirty word for me. The minute you depend on someone, they have power. that every kid knows that. So power dynamic just means that there is a different sense of agency, a different sense of responsibility, because power is also responsibility, that is normal, that is in every relationship. Mm-hmm. Is there the possibility of not having power dynamics around money? Very rarely, because most people decide that the one who's going to manage the money is the one who kind of can add better than the other. I mean, it's often done on the basis of, mm-hmm. or works in something that says they should know money better, which is not at all always the case, that they therefore will be a better investor or manager or mm-hmm. bill payer on time and all of that, mm-hmm. because that too is money. But that doesn't mean that one, that it's an oppressive power. Mm-hmm. Power is not just a power over, it's also power to.
Yeah, I suppose extending that, what is in your experience it look like when a couple healthily navigates that power dynamic?
It's the fact that they can talk about it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. When I looked at all the questions, in the end, the challenge of the question was not the issue. The challenge of the question was how to bring the issue up in the relationship. And therefore, the better management is not about there is no power. It's just that people can bring it up and talk about it. You know, I know you don't really want to move. I know you don't really think we should have a new car, but listen, the tires are falling off. Can you listen to me? Hmm. And can you hear it as care? Because many times it's care rather than control. What happens, what makes a power dynamic fraught is the fact that often care morphs into control or looks like control. And the other person reacts as if you're trying to control when in fact you really are trying to care. So what helps people navigate it the best is their ability to communicate about it in a way that is not instantly reactive and defensive and blaming and all the usual stuff that makes communication miserable and therefore a relationship non-functional. It's not the unique issues around the money. I can't emphasize that enough. You should explain to me. I've already explained it to you. Yeah, but you didn't explain it so I could understand. That's a classic. Oh, take care of me is such an infantile wish so many of us have. Do it for me. I don't really want to. I trust you. No, you would never do anything terrible to me like that, which is often not the case. So what helps? To be adult. To understand the balance between freedom and responsibility. To understand that an adult, as my kid often says, I didn't know that in adulthood you have to do so many things you don't want to do. I thought that was part of childhood. Yes, yes, an adult also does a lot of things that you just don't want to do.
You know, something we've also talked a lot about is actually, frankly, one of the reasons that grounded even what our product looks like is how important it is to both look at the numbers. Because if one person doesn't look at the numbers at all, it really, I think, increases the power dynamic.
Yes.
Where only one person
information
knows.
Is power.
Exactly.
If you're the only one who knows, if you're the only one who knows what is available, what is in the account, what has come in, et cetera, et cetera, you have power. And that doesn't mean it's a problem. But if you use that, it's a problem. If you use it in a way that doesn't keep the interests of everyone in mind. But sometimes people do think they've taken the interest of everybody in mind. They've done this financial providing. And then the family dissolves, which is a high rate of people. And that's when the other person begins to say, but I never, you know, you can come back and say, I didn't know enough. But that's not the ones you're servicing. So mm-hmm. you're servicing people for whom having this thing in front of them, if it's extremely clear, it's like having an advisor. Instead of just relying on my partner to explain to me, I have an advisor explaining to me, which is what I often recommend to people, is get an advisor or get an app. Mm-hmm. It will walk you through it and you can make it go as slow as you need to. You won't push on the button until you figure that thing out.
What would you say to the couple where one person maybe says, oh, my partner works in finance, so he just handles this for us, and my role in our relationship is not to look at the money, is to do other things?
I've done this, been there a few times. I mean, I would have in the past said nothing.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I've changed. Mm-hmm. I would have, this is, I think, very important, is that this has not been a static thing. Where I am today is even influenced by what I'm learning from you mm-hmm. as well. It's like to be more aware of these things and not just say, yeah, why not? You know, seems to work. Is to say that is very nice arrangement, but I'm sure on occasion you want to have a chance to talk with your partner about your kid's school results. That doesn't mean that they're the ones who's talking with the teachers and everything and all. But on occasion, or on occasion you go together to the parent conference because you are both parents of this creature. Well, you are both the guardians of your assets too. Mm. So once a year, I think it's a good thing for you to sit down and have a sense of what's what. I've met too many people mm-hmm. who, when things became problematic, didn't have a clue and it didn't bode well for them. Mm-hmm. Don't put yourself in that kind of vulnerable position. It's just you don't know where this goes mm-hmm. and therefore you should know. And that doesn't mean they will or they won't or that I don't trust. It's the same like with the prenup. Somebody says, why you want to do a prenup? That means that you don't trust me. I wouldn't. No, it's got nothing to do with. And then don't put the trust in it as a way to, you know, look at it as the purpose of the transaction itself. Mm-hmm. So that's what I say today is I understand. I think that in couples divide roles all the time, but it's good to not be completely mm-hmm. ignorant on some things that have such a direct effect on you.
Yeah, well, I think very much adding to that, right? I think one of the things we talk about in the company is you don't need to be the driver. You don't need to drive the decisions mm-hmm. in around money, but you need to be a passenger in the car. And, you know, people don't like to talk about death either. Divorce is hard enough to mm-hmm. talk about, but death is even harder. Yes. And there's unexpected deaths. And that's, you know, another situation where you don't want to be the person who doesn't know where any of the accounts are. You don't even know where to ask to see what your partner.
And then everything is behind a password mm-hmm. in a digital archive, which you have zero access to. That takes a long time to open up to. No, no. All of this, I never thought this was part of therapy, but now I do. I do at least enough to ask the question and say to people, don't let this just, mm-hmm. you know, but the death one is huge. Mm-hmm. The amount of people who don't know where anything is, anything.
And I think something we hear is sometimes one of the reasons for that is, well, it's privacy.
But you are like the estate lawyer, right? You store it.
Yes.
I mean, people store it with an estate lawyer. Exactly. I don't want you to know, but the day you need to, it is somewhere where you can go and get it.
Yeah.
This is what you're going to have in your app too, no?
Yeah.
Okay.
So one of the things we hear a lot of couples navigate is how do we find the balance between what we talk about together versus what we treat as independent and individual money. And that's also a dynamic that we see a lot of times, which leads to ultimately people not necessarily talking about money, people having more things that are private or not looking at what they do together, you know, sitting down. So how do you view or find that balance between togetherness and individuality?
So I start through the back door. I think that the balance of togetherness and separateness mm-hmm. or individuality in a couple is among the two, if not the most important task mm-hmm. of a relationship. I don't have to start with money. The making of a couple is that process of how you come together and you maintain your individuality and come together a little bit more and have a period where the together is the main focus. And then you have the piece where there is more individuality. I mean, it's not static for the course of your life, but it is the most important dynamic thing you manage mm-hmm. in the course of a relationship. And you start with that. And you begin by talking, you know, it goes from, do you wake up together and go to bed together? Do you leave a party together? Mm-hmm. Do you share all your friends? Do you see friends still alone? Mm-hmm. Do you encourage each other to see your friends alone? Do you do every travel together? You broaden it. You first highlight the dimension, the task, the relational task mm-hmm. of managing or balancing individuality and togetherness. And then you just ask it vis-a-vis money. And then the first thing is not how do you balance it, but are people aware that that's something they need to do? And are they aware that this is something that changes? If an accident occurs to me, our balance of interdependence will be different. If one of us, we have a big age gap and one of us becomes older and the other one is still in a different life stage. So this, it's really essential to explain to people it's a relational task and it accompanies you till the relationship is finished or over, whatever the over, you know, reason is. Within that, so is the finances. You know, if you get an inheritance, do you tell your partner what you got? Because as you move, there's a possibility that something like that may come. Or you may get stuck in a company, or you may have suddenly an asset you didn't have. I see this a lot around my friends at this moment because their aging parents are going. An apartment was left somewhere, a little, you know, it doesn't have to be big, but it changes your life sometimes. That little asset that suddenly appears just at a particular moment, you know, a critical moment. How do you?
Ritabazende kize imba izwezi pili lwekeleze mikwaye ngwi encha kukona kunolofaza kwankufisa hamocholo ni mata amskavona kale kana mitukselize kubona msevelezo wa imba ye mufumane lisevelezo zezwezi pili ze ka kulifafela mashilling ali kana $36 million kakweli kapa kamikwaye kutesfa fasi yetatama 5% machipisa hamngolisali kwelize talu 10% machipisa hamngolisali kwelize silela 25% machipisa hamngolisali kwelize lishumi pili muketeli kwelize zo muvata kuri mukone kukala kuikola zendeze wo imba imiswalezi kama chipisa imba pokuvukanira fasi kaufela muipe kwa lisevelezo za imba kachenu kuri mukone kuikola zende kaufela
divide and there is what do you know, there is what do you combine, there is how do you combine, like what are the pieces you should combine. So I think what's interesting in what you're doing is that this is actually not just related to, you're focusing on a particular life stage, but the thing itself, it goes on. It's part of the same task. Now, how do you help people balance it? I think it's the same thing. What has worked for you? First of all, have you talked about it? How have the conversations been? What has worked for you? And what are the changes that you have implemented? Because if people are able to tell you things that they've changed and how did these changes come about, you get a sense of how flexible and adaptive they are. And they can respond to the circumstances of life. Money is not a static thing and the relationship needs to be flexible around that.
I also really liked what you said about the three questions, for the first one being, what do you know? What is that balance between keeping something that is private and it's a good thing and it's an independence, you know, feature, or, and when does it become actually something that is a secret and it's naturally negative or corrosive?
I've had a few secrets recently on the podcast on Where Should We Begin? And it's kids that you didn't know existed that somebody's taking care of. That's money that's going somewhere. You thought the partner was making X, but in fact, they're making a different amount because there's a chunk of it that is going to alimony. And you didn't know that. So financial privacy is one thing. Financial secrecy or dishonesty, or what sometimes people want to cheekily call financial infidelity, is a different story.
How would you define that to a couple? So a couple can answer, am I keeping my privacy and independence, or is this actually something that has become a secret and it's not good for us?
But it depends in the context. You see, every question you ask me relationally for me is contextual. And there's not a one size fits all. In a good situation, how do people know what is entitled for them to be kept private? It starts again. Do you people talk about your exes? Is that a part of the conversation of the relationship? Does this relationship admit that there have ever been other people? Does this relationship admit other people in its midst? Does this relationship admit other partners, more than two? So you get a sense as to where people put the boundaries and what they define as privacy or what they think is part of the common pool of knowledge by asking about other things. Then you say, how does this apply to money?
Yeah.
I don't zoom into the money. I don't zoom into many things. I go and I do like this and I check around. Is it expected? When one of you spends something, at what amount are you expected to let the other person know? 100? 500? You know. Because there's a, and then what are the things that are expected to be discussed? Because sometimes you see a couple and they, if one of them buys tech stuff and a camera and a laptop and a this, it's all supposedly good for the cause, mm-hmm. you know. But if the other one went and bought whatever mm-hmm. that is for the house or for themselves or for that, that is considered, you know, fluffy. So there's a hierarchy. And who gets to decide that? What is worthy or not worthy? And then you get a sense, how is it that when you went to buy that, you don't have to check a thing because you thought we need a new TV screen. But when your partner went to buy a bike, you know, but the TV screen is for everybody, you know, and then you start to see the criteria. Also, so if there is, if it's for everyone, it's allowed. But if it's, and you, for you, the bike, I don't bike, mm-hmm. yeah, but there are other people maybe in this house who see, and you get a, I don't answer the questions. Mm-hmm. I help people to answer their own questions. But I will take them down the road. Mm-hmm. And in the midst, I will say, that's very interesting. Is that a principle you both have agreed on? Mm-hmm. Or is that a principle by which you live? And have you ever bothered checking if your partner lives by the same principle? I don't get that sense. Should we talk about this?
Yeah. And I think there's... especially because there isn't as much of a dynamic nowadays for most couples of, oh, we got married. Everything's fully joined from day one. We moved in for the first time. We bought a house. And there's not as much of that.
I think it's life great to thing. Tell people, sit down and just take a look. Sometimes you say, once a year, you look at the house and you say, what needs fixing here? Sometimes once a year, you say, what would be the trip we would like to take this year? Sometimes once a year, you should sit with your finances and say, where are we at? And not what do we have, but how are we managing relationally? What would you like to change in the way we've been managing the money?
Yeah.
Why? Just asking that question to your partner mm-hmm. will go a long way.
I think that really resonates for us because about once a year, we have thought about the system of how we manage money. Because when we first started dating, many things were private. That was normal. When we got engaged, I think we started sharing more about our own money. But, you know, even about last year after we got married, we did make the decision that we would be sharing pretty much all of the information, though with the requirement that if we bought things each independently, there wasn't going to be a, why did you buy that if we spent it on our own personal cards?
Mm-hmm.
But we think a lot, I think, about the system of managing money. And, you know, when we first started building Plenty, I wasn't convinced that there would be certain frameworks that would be helpful or applicable for most couples because every couple is different. There isn't a one size fits all.
But that doesn't mean the framework isn't, the framework is beyond useful.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that, but the framework is there to frame and you need to fill in the middle. So, it's not because I say it's what people decide, but they decide and you present frames to them.
Yeah.
So what are some of the best systemic frames you have found about that?
I think, you know, we've experienced this where our income has changed. And as we think about years in the future, I think that will continue to evolve. You know, sometimes one person earns more, one person earns less. But going back to what you said earlier about the resources, it's supported by the other partner. And I think when we think about that for ourselves, I think the language you use is extremely important.
Yep.
So whether or not you say, I earn, you earn, or we earn this much, you know, together, this is how much we've brought in.
Yes.
I think that fundamentally shifts and captures the fact that even if one person might have a higher income, they are supported by the other partner often.
Right.
And so you also, I think, then end up working together more like a team, because you're really thinking about how do we as a team, you know, earn more of that
so
a priority.
Then if you sit in my office, my question to you is, how do you feel about the we and how do you feel about the I? Do you like your balance?
Yeah.
Does the balance work? And if both people tell me the balance works, mm-hmm. then I'm not looking for problems where there are none. And sometimes that may mean where one says to the other, you do it. I cannot say, hey, that's not a good idea. I can just say, I think you should know more. But this we, so when does a couple come? When the we is choking the I, or when the I has created too much distance and there is not enough we. That is a lot of what couples therapy is about.
I think, well, one of the things we thought about from a framework to capture that, because I think as us as individuals, for all the couples that we've seen and worked with or have used our product, I do think having both is important to some degree for every couple.
Not to some degree. It's essential.
Yes.
That is the most important frame. Mm-hmm. The frame of I and we, the frame of together apart, individual connected, is the most important frame of relationship. All relational systems, by the way. Not just romantic. And therefore, the money is one of the places, one of the hubs where this dynamic of we and I plays itself out all the time.
I think one of the things that sometimes surprises couples that we've talked to or worked with is how important having both is. And it's also sometimes hard because it's not something we've ever been taught to decide how that works with money.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that we typically recommend, and of course this doesn't always work because every couple's different, is you start off with, this is how much we earn.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much the we.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about what do we spend, you know, the shared expenses, whether that's the rent, the mortgage, the car, the utilities, then capturing that there are things because you're in a relationship that you want to do together down the road.
Mm-hmm.
But then finally getting down to after you take out money that you're saving, money that you've spent, making sure that the money that is left over is actually split. So you each have some money that that you can do whatever you want. If you want to invest it, if you want to spend it, if you want to, whatever you want to do.
It's ours that we give to each of us alone.
Exactly. Almost like an allowance, you know, but like an adult allowance.
I think that's it's very clever because the first three are reinforcing the relationship. Us, what we have. Us what we would like to have, and us what we need to disburse. And then to make sure that there's a space left in the midst of us for each of us individually that is not accountable to the other so that we can still feel free and not feel like we have to ask permission because we don't want to regress either. And I think that that's a very, very smart setup, actually, that you can apply to many things.
How would you think about applying that to things outside of money?
What are the things that you want to, that are important for you to do together? The holidays are important for us to do together. Things that where you count on each other's presence. Because a major issue in many relationships is I don't have to go there. It's not my thing. It's your thing. You go. Not interested. You know, why do I have to go to that? No, because it's part. So what is tradition? What is important? Are the family holidays important? Are the games important? Are the certain kind of trips important? You know, Sunday this, name it. So you have less of the what do we need to spend piece, but where do we want to be later on around that? Well, later on when I stop working or when I work less or when I travel less for work, I would like to be able to do this and this and this. And then what are the things that you just want to do alone? Why do you keep trying to force your partner to go see movies that they really couldn't care less about? Go by yourself. Find somebody else. What are the conversations that you shouldn't be having with your partner because they're never satisfying? Find somebody else to have those conversations. What kind of trips would you like to take that your partner isn't interested in? Or sports activities that you would like to do that you don't go because they don't want to go and you don't want to be away. Go do your thing. So what are the things that the relationship needs in order to anchor itself into something that is solid and brings communality and shared reality and shared experience? And what are the things that the relationship can afford to give more freedom to each of the people who are in it? Because the anchor allows you to also open up and breathe. I mean, but that fits my model.
Mm-hmm.
It works for me because it resonates very much with how I conceptualize relationships. So I apply this you know, it's part of why what you do makes so much sense to me. And because this, what I call the essential dynamic, is the way I map a relationship on all aspects. We don't eat this. We don't eat this. You know, it's like, I mean, this moment that you described, it was so funny. It's like the instead of I don't try to say anything is to actually make a joke and say, you know how hard I'm trying not to say anything, because it becomes funny after a while. It's like, is that he's thinking about his delicious omelet while you're thinking about, you know, this is going to be like a $30 omelet.
Yeah.
You know, who can enjoy that? That would make me feel guilty just before I even took a bite. But it's funny. And when couples can make that funny, then they live with their differences in their midst, and they create, you know, a harmony around these differences. Because the second most important dynamic in the couple is differences. One is together, we and I, the second, but we and I live, is part of differences. It's an extension of that. So the second one is how much difference can you tolerate in your midst?
Yeah, I'm thinking that more of what you just said, where getting those differences out and not expecting to have no differences. Because I think a lot of times we come from this model of obviously what I think is right and my framework is right, and embracing the reality that you're going to have different frameworks. You're going to have different ways of thinking about everything in a relationship, but especially money, and talking about those things and being willing to understand the other person's differences, mm-hmm. and then bringing humor to it. And also being willing to understand that, you know, maybe the avocado and the bacon actually are worth it on the omelet.
It's very difficult to explain that the money is a piece of it, but the money in the relationship is defined by the relationship.
Yeah.
And not by the money. I mean, the money, the ability, the scarcity of it, the having of it, the struggle around it influences a relationship a lot. I think it's one of the biggest stressors. There's no doubt. But on the other side, the way that the relationship manages whatever issues around money determines the experience, not the money itself. That I wasn't even as aware of as since I began to look at the way people formulate their questions and what's at stake, you know, what they really are worried about when they're going to have the conversation. And how do you help people have these difficult conversations? Because in 10 things that you people talk about money, for many other people would be very complicated. But you are, for you, that's not your area. And every couple has an area. And then you tell them, but you have 5 other things that you never argue about, and there's no problem. You discuss, mm-hmm. Those are not your issues. This is your Achilles' heel. That's when it's problematic. The next piece of it is, how do you actually say, in the making of a couple, you will be a better couple if you manage your money well together. If money is part of the relational conversation from the beginning.
In that vein, one of the things we talk about and we strongly recommend is getting a prenup. And obviously there's
you got one and you wrote a piece about it, but what did you say in it that we should hear?
One of the things that I think is most important about a prenup is it requires you to have this conversation. It requires you to put all of your assets and liabilities on the table and share them with each other. Have a conversation about who owns and owes what, how the money and assets that are acquired during the relationship, will be owned. And it also brings to light the reality that, at least in the United States, which state you live in and which state you get married in will determine the laws around property ownership in your marriage. Yeah. And they might be completely arbitrary and not at all what you think they are. Having a prenup allows you to create a foundation that is what you want it to be. And it can be pretty much whatever you want it to be. Something that we've talked about a lot, and we've heard from a lot of couples that have gone through the process.
And what is their biggest challenge around the process?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for having joined us on these conversations. I hope that you guys have learned. I hope that you guys have heard. I hope you guys have had time to hear other couples' conversations, especially around money. I hope that you guys have put a few things to good use, okay? So from me, the matriarch, I bid you farewell. See you on Wednesday. Bye-bye.